everybody. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the world's fourth greatest movie podcast, where we tell you what to watch, but mostly you tell us what to watch. But in the end, we watch it. So here we are. Again, I'm Roy, and I have written a completely original musical called Gentle and Soft, featuring all of the songs from the album Catalina Breeze by the Blue Jean Committee.
Hey, everybody. I'm John, and the webs are alive with the sound of podcasts.
Well, hey, I'm Richard, and I just have to say, even when the music starts to play and we hear a mashup, that's okay. When the story turns out sad, we are still glad. We are still glad. We are still glad to have 21st century musicals.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. I didn't want to sing too much because I knew you'd take us all the way into Act Two with your intro. I was depending on it.
Yay.
No, that was great. If you can't tell or haven't been paying attention, we are watching three 21st century musicals. This is our second time with Richard. Welcome back, Richard.
Good to be back. Thank you.
You could almost say third time or second and a half time because we just finished last week doing the live show. And gents, what did you think? Was it a good live show? I listened to the podcast and it sounds pretty good.
It was so thrilling to be there live that I thought it was worth the whole big to-do, and we should to do it again.
We need to do it again because it was better than I thought it could be, but also there were so many things that I know we could have done better now that we've done it once, you know? For one thing, I think we definitely need more of a communal infectious microphone in the audience. We didn't use that enough. I think we missed a little bit of audience opportunities, but we kept it tight. Maybe we can even go a little longer next time. So I don't know, Lots of different things, but all I know is it was funner than I thought it would be even.
Yeah. I thought it was better than I thought it'd be. We had a really good time.
One change relatively I would make... low infection rate.
Do you know anyone else that, like, I mean, has anyone else reached back and said, thanks for the COVID, you bunch of idiots?
As long as you're okay.
Yeah. So I guess I'll mention that because my voice probably sounds pretty crappy. I definitely had COVID symptoms the day after our live podcast. And then it's crazy because I think my oldest son, who was at the podcast, he got it and brought it home. And then within 2 days, 8 people in this house had it. So that thing spreads. Anyway.
He's talented.
Yeah, he's pretty talented. We're watching three fascinating films. These are 21st century musicals. Now, two of them are not, I don't know if you can call them original musicals. So we're watching Moulin Rouge, Across the Universe, and Dear Evan Hansen. So Moulin Rouge and Across the Universe take already existing music and adapt a story around them. And I think Moulin
Rouge
maybe... They're
disqualified is what you're saying.
They're disqualified. Moulin Rouge maybe does it a little more creatively. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. But those are the three movies we're here to talk about. And I really enjoyed all of them, if I'm being honest. I had a really good time with all of them. And so I'd seen Moulin Rouge before, but I was surprised. I think I liked it better than my memory was giving me credit for. And then really nervous about Dear Evan Hansen, just from the critical unacclaim or non-acclaim, whatever you want to call it. But I'm excited to talk about it as well.
There's a certain sense of, you know, genuineness, but we have to talk about that because, the fakest of all of these, I might have some more genuine affection for, if that means anything. And the, like the purest, of all of these, you know, maybe doesn't, like maybe seem as pure, and it's so interesting that we did it like 21st century musicals. This is what 21st century musicals are, that art is created pretty much by sampling other things. And that's how we work now. And I don't know if it's because we've already thought of everything, and so this is the only way we can do it, because mathematically all the notes have been played, you know, throughout history. And so we just have to change it slightly to come up with new things. But I thought it was just a fascinating look, these three.
So Moulin Rouge is basically 80s and 90s music, right? And then Across the Universe is all 60s music, but we're counting them as 21st century musicals. And to be fair, like Cats was written back in 19 or 1830 or whatever, right? But we would have counted it because the movie was produced in the 21st century. So that wasn't necessarily our criteria. It's when the movie came out at theaters, right? So
I mean, it's funny, like that's the thing about 21st century musicals in cinema.
Yeah.
Is okay, chances are it's something that's existed for a long time because it took that long to, you know, get into the theater, or took that long to get into the theater a second or third time.
Yeah. So any regrets on movies that we didn't choose? I still think it would have been fun to have gushed over Les Miserables and complained about what's his head? Fat Maximus. I can't think of his name. Russell Crowe.
Russell,
yeah.
Yeah. And while watching these
Russell
three movies,
complain about him.
During each movie, I'm like, he could have played Javert. He could have played Javert. He could have played Javert. but anyway, what can you do? Here we are. These are the movies we watched.
I will tell you more regrets after I tell you maybe my rankings. Maybe I'll save that.
Okay. All right. Well, John, you're fortunate enough to start us off with Moulin Rouge.
Moulin Rouge.
It's a trilogy.
Wait, what do you mean it's a trilogy? Because of Strictly Ballroom and Romeo and Juliet?
Yes, it's a loose trilogy, right?
Yes.
It's a Toulouse trilogy.
Oh, you're clever.
I mean, it is kind of nice. It's the Red Curtain trilogy, is that what it is?
Something like that.
Doesn't it seem a little bit like... He's like, after he made Moulin Rouge and he kind of realized, like, oh, I can just call this a trilogy and people will believe me. Kind of. I was actually listening to a podcast just now and like someone said, oh yeah, this is a trilogy. It's the Red Curtain trilogy. You know, one is dance and one is literature and one is music. And one of the other hosts of the podcast said, are you sure it wasn't like a Pee Wee Herman situation where he fell off his bike and said, I meant to do that?
So if Steven Spielberg had done Jaws, Duel, and Indiana Jones and then declared them a trilogy.
Yes.
Okay.
This is my shark / land car trilogy. Yeah. okay, I want to ask you about that. What do you think of Baz Luhrmann? What do you think of his trilogy? And also, what do you think of all his other movies that you've obviously never seen? Because I haven't seen any of his other movies, really.
Like, so, Strictly Ballroom, I haven't seen.
Okay, I have seen that. That was a very big movie when my brothers were at BYU going to ballroom dance classes. And so it was a huge hit in that realm. And I must say, I actually saw Strictly Ballroom before I saw Moulin Rouge. It didn't take for me. I'll just say that.
So I have some affection for Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. which I think maybe fits in the most loosely with this trilogy, right?
Yeah, I would say.
But I think it was popular to not like it because there was like some, what would you call it, some backlash against that sexy Leonardo DiCaprio, but I think it's pretty good.
I mean, you know what? I didn't really care for Romeo and Juliet. I really appreciated Baz Luhrmann's writing. I don't know how he came up with it in the story and those characters. They really came alive, you know, alive for me. So I respect him for, the screenplay I thought was really well conceived. Oh. No, but actually, seriously, I kind of thought Romeo and Juliet played a little bit too much with the, hey, we're being playful in anachronistic times.
Yeah.
And it didn't hit that way for me. It was like, okay, hey, get a load of this. You know, I call this like, I don't know. I always think of this part, like when Brian Dennehy says, I must reach for my longsword.
I was
going to
say that. Exactly that.
Fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, and he's reaching for his rifle in the car, you know, and it just says longsword on it. It's like, ooh, clever. It's a weapon, but we're modernizing it. And it's like, you can do that. That's totally fine. That's great. But it's just a little too much, you know, what I may have found cool in middle school when they do something like that. I don't need called out to me as an adult.
So I haven't seen.
So that's a little bit Romeo and Juliet, yeah.
I haven't seen Australia or Gatsby, so I really don't know.
I love Australia, but that one suffers from having several endings to the film where an hour and a half in, you're like, oh, what a great resolution to this movie. And they're like, oh, there's another one. All right. At 2 hours, you're like, oh, that's a great ending to this film. And then like at 2.5 hours, it finally does end. And you're like, it was beautiful. It was breathtaking. But yeah, it ended several times in the production.
So about halfway through Evan Hansen, I thought it was a beautiful ending. But then the movie kept going. And it was a less fun ending. It was a less happy. Anyway, we'll get there. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, I was very curious about Baz Luhrmann because I'll just say up front before I forget. I don't know. I always try to keep secret, you know, what I think of films of these movies that we talk about before we actually get to the end when we give our big awards and rankings and everything.
Yeah.
But I just find Moulin Rouge so fascinating because I've had. Every time I've dipped my toe in the water that is Baz Luhrmann, I always kind of cringe away with this exception. There's something about the Baz Luhrmann treatment of Moulin Rouge that kind of gets me, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe you guys can help me figure that out. Moulin Rouge, Paris, 1900. It's exactly 101 years prior to the making of this movie. Mm-hmm. So Ewan McGregor plays Christian, a writer, and he's heard about the bohemian lifestyle of Paris, and he wants to be an artist, he wants to be a writer. So he comes, and he just starts hanging out. He's like looking for opportunities. He meets his neighbor, Toulouse Lautrec, and his band of merry theater-goers. And he kind of, because he's more talented than they are right from the beginning, he kind of wheedles his way into their production company. And they're doing a production of what seems to be The Sound of Music. Before The Sound of Music comes out, before Nazi Germany happens, before all of that. And so they hatch this plan, and I'm trying to figure out the plan. Toulouse Lautrec arranges a meeting with Satine the courtesan, and if he can impress Satine, then she can tell her boss, Harold Zeller, to front the money for their production, right?
Yes.
In the meantime, Satine and Harold Ziegler are doing the same thing with someone else, someone with more money, because they need money as well to do what they're doing. And so Ziegler arranges a meeting with this guy, the Duke, who has all sorts of money, and he presumes the Duke to be also very lecherous and who can easily possibly be swayed by the charms of Satine, the courtesan. Anyway, at the big party, and it's you know, mistaken identity, no blame to anyone because that was a crazy, hectic, weird party. And it was nuts in that room. So
was that
no
that
blame
party,
to anyone for not understanding.
That party was like you got shot in the face with a shotgun of party.
Yes.
Like it was madness, right? And this whole film kind of feels like that. It's sort of an unrelenting film of mm-hmm. kind of craziness.
It's zero relent. I think it's funny, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about Across the Universe in this movie. I found them similarly. I think you can call both of them unrelenting.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Unrelenting in a different way.
COVID. Like, oh, you got it.
I know. I'm sorry. Yeah. No, my throat is dry. Yeah. It's a bummer. I don't know. I'm like, I could have it. I might just be tougher than you are. You ever think of that? Every once in a while, like, I could.
Well, there's no doubt. So, one of the
No. Wait. Sorry. I didn't want to forget what I was
going
to say.
Going.
I feel like Moulin Rouge is unrelenting, like a wave passing through you or being caught away in it a little bit. And it's like, oh, this river that I'm caught up in, it kind of doesn't stop for that reason. And then Across the Universe felt to me a little unrelenting, as in I'm standing on the beach and the wave keeps hitting me over and over again.
Oh, so I would say that Moulin Rouge felt unrelenting to me in the way that if you're at your birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese and all the rats have gathered around you and they're screaming at you to blow out the candles, but you're too terrified to blow out the candles. So
that's a deep reference that I'm not sure I'm getting because I think I have COVID fog brain.
Oh, okay. You never did a party at Chuck E. Cheese with the weird rat band?
Were there tons of rats? I thought it was just the Chuck E. Cheese band.
It's the Chuck E. Cheese band, but they're all rats. They're like Chicago gangster rats for some reason. I don't know why.
Maybe I'm more familiar with Showbiz Pizza Band. Because wasn't there like a bear or something?
I don't know. Richard, am I wrong? Have you ever done a birthday at Chuck E. Cheese?
Yes, I've done several birthdays in my childhood at Chuck E. Cheese. I think it's mainly rats in the band. Yeah.
Nothing says delicious pizza like rats. So
it was before Pizza Rat even was born. So
yeah. society converges on itself. No, that's great. Okay, no, let me go on.
Go on.
So the mistaken identity. Satine thinks Ewan McGregor is the handsome young Duke. And of course, I mean, right, you see a young Ewan McGregor. This is 2 years after the first Star Wars movie, and he's got that scarf. I mean, of course he's the handsome young Duke. So that's him, and she tries to seduce him because she thinks she needs his money. What she doesn't know is that he needs her support in the production of the play that they're trying to put on.
Yeah.
It doesn't take too long for her to figure it out. It's not like Mistaken Identity, the whole movie, thank goodness, because that's just annoying.
There's a weird part, right? Like where like she's kind of going crazy. Like she's really enjoying herself, even though he's just reading poetry. Like his poetic words are just making her have a good time. And I just don't understand. I don't understand that. I'm not sure like if she's trying to say your poetry is so impressive, it's making this happen to me. So I just, it seems like if I was Ewan McGregor, I would probably run away because I'd be frightened of what was happening. But anyway, I don't know. Maybe my poetry maybe is not good enough.
Again, this is Nicole Kidman. This is just a few years after Batman Forever. Nicole Kidman at her height. Both of these people, that's the thing. I was thinking that. Like, Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman, it's like they are at the height of their powers right now. and the reason she was acting so weird, right, is because she had a job to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so she was it's kind of funny. I guess she's a little bit better at falling in love than actually seducing someone because she actually kind of didn't do that very well at all.
Yeah.
Once that's figured out, she's like, oh, okay, you know, I am in love with you. Let's get this thing put on. And then she eventually kind of seduces the Duke. But since she's kind of in love with Christian, she kind of tells the Duke, hey, you can have me. I'm part of the deal. But let's wait till opening night because we have this really great production. And so they call it's synergy, right? Everybody benefits from each other. It's a wonderful deal, and that is capitalism at work. Mm. It's everyone working together for the common good, and nothing will ever go wrong. No one will ever get greedy about anything. No one will ever get jealous. Nothing. Everything's just fine. So
yeah, she tells Christian that he's not allowed to get jealous, and he says he will never get jealous. But that never happens. You can't. That's not a thing that would ever happen. Not getting jealous.
Yeah, let's not talk about our feelings as if they're decisions that we make.
Yeah.
Maybe let's not do that. Maybe let's talk about our feelings about where we can go from here. Maybe let's do that. So in the meantime, the jealousy happens. The Duke, he's kind of baring his fangs, and he really wants to eventually – he's cool with the production as long as he can, you know, have Satine. But also he's got his reputation at stake. He obviously comes to realize that the play is about him and how evil he is and how – he doesn't like that the play is about the bohemian lifestyle and, you know, the message of truth, beauty, love, freedom. Mm. Truth, beauty, freedom, and most of all, love. Right?
I thought it was magic, sex, drug. I can't remember.
It could be those things. A lot of things can be justified in the bohemian lifestyle. Yeah. Of course.
So, do you think he's catching on before Sadie? Not Satine, but Sadie, the other dancer, like blows it. Right? She's like, it's not realistic that the courtier would end up with the writer. Oops, I mean the sitar player.
Sitar player.
So yes. Was he just like lying to himself until that point, or was he really oblivious?
I think he was oblivious to the extent that, okay, there are the Bohemian ideals, and then there are his ideals, which is, hey, I'm a powerful person. I have money. I can make these things happen. And that is – and you know what? He's – I kind of wish this was explored just a little bit more. He kind of says in one line, look, I don't believe in your dogma. I believe in money and power and security. You know, probably the most positive word in that. He's like, okay, you Bohemians, you live in poverty and you think you can live on love, and that's not enough. This is the real world. And so I think he was living in the real world, and I think he was depending on them living in the real world too. But they're not. They're totally Bohemians. The thing is, so they put on the play, they write a secret song, and I did skip a lot of stuff, but ultimately we kind of know what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen, and Ewan McGregor, he finds his way on stage. He gets in the right costume, and you know he insults her because he calls her a whore and everything. He's very upset because the plan is that she would leave him and settle with the Duke because the production needs the Duke's money, and that's just the fact of life. But okay, if anybody knows me and my theater lifestyle, I just hate it when the actors do aisle work. The aisle is my domain. You're up on the stage. I hate it when you do aisle work. I hate it when you associate with people in the audience. That is an invasion of my space. But
so you hated the play at the end of Babes in Arms. They were all over the aisles.
Yes.
Okay.
I hated when I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast, but when I saw Camelot a couple months ago at Hale Center Theater, and I was like, I was on the front row, and I was pretty much just in the play. I was just in it. I was just in the play because, like, the spotlight was on me because I was so close to the action. And I had to make sure to tuck my feet underneath the chair to make sure I didn't trip the actors, because that would have been a huge disaster. Like, that was going to happen. Okay. And when I say I hated it, it was a wonderful production. I'm just saying, you know, keep to your own domain, you know, you up there on the stage. But no. But this – The play in Moulin Rouge, it was so great at the end because they did aisle work in the play because Christian, he told her off, he said his feelings, and then he walks down the aisle of the theater, you know, among the people, and then she sings the secret song to him, and she says love conquers all, and then they sing the secret song to each other. They tell the Duke to stuff it. He tries to kill him, but then they knock his gun over the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
and everybody gets, you know, just how they deserve, and everyone's in love, and everything's wonderful. Here's the thing that they don't write into the play. They don't write into the play within the play that Satine is dying. And that is the trump card that Ziedler has. That's why he says, okay, you can't have the freedom you want. You can't have the love you want. There are certain things in this world that, you know, no matter how powerful we become, that oppress us in that way. And so there's the complete parallel to what's happening in real life, or what we call real life, the Baz Luhrmann real life, which is very surreal, and then what they're trying to put in the play. And I think that's the thing that's missing, the inevitable death of Satine that takes away her ability to run away from the Moulin Rouge with Christian, you know, where they can start over and do whatever they want. And I kind of found it cool at the end because, you know, we know that at the very beginning. I should have said that at the beginning of my summary. Hey, Satine's going to die because they tell us in the first 30 seconds of the whole movie.
Yeah.
But it kind of is hopeful in a way because, you know, she wishes and, you know, they finally encourage Christians, like, okay, you're still able to write, and we're able, in spite of this great tragedy, the love you shared can be shared. And that's what we do when we create these bohemian arts. It is living in the clouds. It is, you know, perhaps, it's naive thinking to, you know, consider just beauty and all these things and to only think about the kind of beauty without living in the real world. But we're able to do that. And it's important that we do that, in spite of the real life tragedy. And so that wasn't in the play, but, that's the bohemian life and those are the bohemian ideals. Anyway, and curtain falls on Moulin Rouge. That's it. That's all we're talking about.
Ooh. Okay.
So did you like the movie then?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, well, you said...
I've seen it before.
When did you see it? Did you see it in the theater? Has it been that long?
I would love to have seen it in the theater, but the answer is no, I did not. But it's been probably 2 decades since I've seen it. I think I saw it fairly contemporaneously to when it was released.
Right. So, So 20 years. Richard, do you have a history with Moulin Rouge?
I do. I don't believe I saw it in theaters. However, when it came out on DVD after it had done its rounds in the cinema, I purchased it, and it was a double disc DVD with all the special features. And I had friends and family members that we would watch it all summer long, like it would be constantly on repeat. So we would memorize all the songs, we sang along to all the songs, and knew all the dialogue. So even though I had taken like a 10 to 15 year break on the movie, I pressed play on it recently, and I was like, oh, I still remember this line and that line, and I was just quoting and singing along the whole time again.
I'm impressed with myself with how well I know it. I think I probably saw it twice, but it was way back when it first came out. I actually learned a lot of popular songs that I should have known from Moulin Rouge. I think the big one, I don't know about anybody else, but I was made for loving you, baby.
Oh,
you
that was
were
great.
Made for loving me, which is a Kiss song.
A beautiful Kiss
which
song.
Which I didn't learn until later. The big one, though, somehow, you know, I was like 20-something. I can't remember when Moulin Rouge came out, but... I was like, is this an original song? And the song I thought was an original song was Your Song by Elton John, which somehow amazingly weaved its way out of my life up until that point. The first time I ever heard Your Song was when Ewan McGregor sings it in Moulin Rouge.
Oh, wow. So would you say that's the central song, or would you say the central song that ties this movie together is Nature Boy?
Yeah, the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return, probably.
Which I don't really love that song. I mean, that line's great. It's a great line, right?
Yeah, it's a central line.
Yeah, and it's what Tua Luce yells at the end when it looks like all is lost as he falls from the sky onto the stage, right? That's his line.
Yeah.
But so, again, we've discussed it. This movie, like, it uses a bunch of songs, so... I assume that in the case of this film, that the story was written and then they found appropriate music to slip in, as opposed to they had a bunch of popular classics and they wrote a story around it. This feels more like they found music to fit what they were writing, right?
Yes, and I can confirm that too, that they actually set out to do an original Baz Luhrmann musical, like him and his writers were going to write a musical. So they had a story and they were like, you know what we can do is we'll just put placeholders of the songs we want to write by putting popular songs in place of what we're going to write later. And as they were doing it, they're like, actually, no song we could write would be better than some of these songs that we're putting in as placeholders. So they're like, should we switch gears and make this kind of a jukebox musical of 20th century songs? Mm. And kind of do it that way. And they were like, okay. And so they approach Elton John and they're like, we really need your song for the film if we're going to do this. And Elton said, yeah, use it. And also tell everybody you approach that you already have my sign off on your song. And that should help the sway of getting all the rights. And there was only a couple of people, a couple of bands and artists that did not agree to it, but so many acquiesced, including Courtney Love, with Kurt Cobain's song.
seen Spider-Man.
Which she never.
I was just going to say, thank goodness Kurt Cobain died. I'm sorry I'm saying that.
He never would have agreed.
He wouldn't have agreed, yeah.
So then she normally doesn't agree, but she allowed that to happen. I think it was the power of Elton.
Yeah. So let me ask your impression then of several songs, Kay. Like, liked it or didn't like it? Not as far as, like, do you like the song, but in the movie, Kay? Okay. So, Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
That one's okay. I like it. I know a lot of people who are like, whoa, that's blasphemy. That's
fine. Okay.
I mean, it fits the moment, though.
I think it does. Actually, when they start singing, like, hey, but I think it works pretty well. Okay, how about, let's see, Like a Virgin.
That not my favorite.
That's because it's one of those things. I don't like the decision to use the song, but that's a Ziedler great. He sells it in the.
I think Ziedler sells it really well. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So how about All You Need Is Love? So I think you only hear that line, right? They just sing because this is
you
part
only
of
hear
the
that line. Well,
love montage.
But it's so perfect because, I mean, I think the Beatles, and we'll probably talk about this in a few minutes again.
I think
the Beatles were, they came not like under fire, but I think they were just kind of a little bit criticized with All You Need Is Love because they were trying to sort things out. They were trying to kind of sort out the 60s, you know, because it was getting so complicated and weird. And, you know, so they did All You Need Is Love, you know, as well as like Revolution, saying, hey, everybody calm down.
Yeah.
These are the important things. And by using All You Need Is Love, just that one line, and then having a criticism of All You Need Is Love in the next line, I think it's really great.
Yeah. So, okay, the last one I'll do is Roxanne.
You didn't like it, I know.
I didn't like it. I don't know. I just couldn't get sold on it. So I know, Richard, because this was you were introduced to the song Roxanne through Moulin Rouge. So, angry bias, that's fine. But, John, what do you think?
Oh, I love Roxanne.
You love Roxanne in this movie? Okay.
In the movie. And especially in the thing about all of these songs is, you know, they don't just depend on it's like, hey, remember this song? Hey, remember this song? But I think Roxanne, it's so different and so unique, but also it's kind of another song. Like they write an entire different part of it. And I think it's like something that works really well. There's the round, like the Christian part of Roxanne, I think is a great song in itself. And it's a completely different song. And it works so well, like counterbalancing with, you know, what the Argentinian is singing.
Okay. All right. So let's see. I don't think there's any other songs I want to talk about. I will say one of the goofs that was mentioned for this movie on IMDb is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It was that that they're in Paris, so why is everyone speaking English? And I don't even know how to respond to a goof like that.
It's like, where did we make the film? Like, we made it for an American audience.
Yeah, I don't know. So, whatever. Oh, no, Richard, you've seen the stage production recently, right?
I did want to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Oh, yes.
Compare and contrast, sir.
I will. They added a bunch of great bangers from the 21st century that were not included because this was made, we said, 2001. So they were concentrating on all the songs that were written up until 1999. Yeah. And so they didn't have access to the new songs. So they change a lot. Like when Satine is singing her diamond song, she's like, diamonds are forever. So it's just like updated. And then Toulouse sings, I've never been a dime, never been called a diamond in the rough. And like, so, so like they update so many of the songs that it makes it a whole brand new experience. And they streamline a little bit of the plot. I notice they open with the Moulin Rouge can-can number. And then in the middle of that song, they do a little catch up to be like, all right, I'm Christian. These are my friends, Toulouse and the Argentinian. And those are basically the only two Bohemian guys he hangs out with. There's other people like in the background, but they're not explored at all because you have to kind of streamline it for the stage. But Toulouse is an average-sized person in the musical. Makes sense because if you're going for a
more traditional casting, you can't always have a little person to be available. Even though historically the reason they made him a little person was because Toulouse in real life was a little person, but they're just going with the flow.
It may not be that important that he's a little person to have John Leguizamo just walking on his knees the whole movie. I don't know how important that was to do it that way.
Right. That seemed like a very 2001 way of solving that issue.
So speaking of, do you love John Leguizamo's Toulouse, or does he drive you crazy? Love him or hate him?
I love him.
I love him.
Yeah.
I love him, but he's my least favorite character in the movie.
Well, there's a lot of good characters.
Yeah.
I think it's funny that in the Broadway version, Aaron Tveit as Christian, he's American instead of British, which that's fine too. Yeah. And he sings he Rickrolls in the show, which is great because that's an important song of the 20th century that they reincorporated. I bet that they couldn't get the rights for some of the songs that they had for the movie, so they had to explore other options as well.
So there's a Lady Gaga song, there's an Outkast song, right?
During the tango, they're not singing Roxanne anymore. They are singing the Lady Gaga. Oh, now it's escaping my head. Ba ba la la la, ba ba roma ma gaga, oh ah ah. Your bad romance.
Bad romance, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Okay.
We got there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a good update too. Like the Roxanne, I think, is great in the movie, but if you want to update it, Gaga is great for a little tango scene.
Sure.
I don't think he's narcoleptic in the musical.
Oh, no. That's one of my favorite parts of the movie, that he's just narcoleptic.
It's a very good portion of the movie, like for the plot. But yeah, I think for the musical, again, we're streamlining it. We're not doing it exactly the same, but I think it's a good adaptation because they changed it. I think because you're going to watch the musical and it's nothing like the movie, but it's the same as the movie. So you get both.
Mm. All right then.
Well, yeah, that's all I had to say, unless you had something else to say about it.
I don't think I do. I thought I had like something, but I don't, because whatever. John, you have anything else you want to talk about for Moulin Rouge? Moulin Rouge. Oh, I guess Moulin Rouge was kind of the great hope to revive musicals in the 21st century, right? Because there had been kind of a lull.
Yeah.
And this was the first big one, right? This was the first shot out of the cannon. Was it successful? Did this movie usher in a new era of musicals, or have we just kind of continued to get them a little at a time? What do you think? Did this movie help?
I will say that the next year we got Chicago, the movie, and that won Best Picture. So technically, I think it worked. But then, of course, it's been sluggish over the last few years until actually 2021, a bunch came out.
Well, I kind of feel like it did a lot for jukebox musicals. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's like, okay, this jump started, Chicago is kind of – Chicago, Les Miserables, those are kind of the exceptions. And I think they're kind of expected because it's like, okay, hey, they were big hits. I mean, people were clamoring for Les Miserables for years and years and years and years. Yeah. Ever since, it was a big hit in the 80s. It's like, okay, when are we going to get the musical? When are we going to be able to see all this? But, after this you get the, Mamma Mia becomes like a big movie thing.
Yeah.
And so much so that they make a second Mamma Mia movie, which I don't think they ever did a second Mamma Mia play.
Yeah.
Unless I'm wrong. But I think it's correct. Just like, oh, we see opportunity for the, and then we get stuff like, what's that Tom Cruise one? Rock of Ages, I think. Rock of Ages doesn't happen unless Moulin Rouge happens. And it's so, like, oh, look at what we could do with Moulin Rouge. Let's do it with Rock of Ages. And they did not do it with Rock of Ages.
I mean, so then do we have like directors for Mamma Mia or Across the Universe who saw Moulin Rouge and said, oh, this works, and they can do this for their own project?
I think so. Like, We watched these back to back. We watched Moulin Rouge and Across the Universe, and I think Julie Taymor probably was aware of Baz Luhrmann's work and kind of directed Across the Universe in a way that is kind of complementary to Moulin Rouge. It's kind of doing its own thing, but not, because it's leaning on a lot of the things we saw in the first movie.
So Across the Universe, was it just a movie, or was it a stage production before it was a movie? I'm not aware. Yes. It was. Okay.
Well, no, I don't think it was. Looked. I tried to find research if they turned it into a musical, and I think they might have tried, but it didn't go to Broadway or anything. So no.
Okay.
So then you have Moulin Rouge, that's a movie musical that they turned into a Broadway show. Across the Universe, which is just a musical movie, and Dear Evan Hansen, which is a Broadway show that they turned into a movie.
See how well we balance these things?
This all makes total sense now. And Richard, what you said about Moulin Rouge makes total sense, that they had a story and they had temp music to go with their story, and then they just settled in on the music that already existed. And that sounds like, oh my gosh, what a huge embarrassing disaster. I kind of think that worked really well. But when you see that and you're like, oh, hey, let's do the same thing. Let's use nothing but Beatles songs, and it's a gold mine. I kind of get the sense that it was a little bit more the songs governing where the story went rather than having the story in place.
So I agree 100%. So I think – we're about to talk about it, right? So we'll talk about it, but I agree with you 100%, and we'll talk about it. In fact, are you guys ready?
Sure.
I think so.
Richard, it's all you.
All right. Again, I'm not very great at doing these recaps, but I will do my best. So we're juxtaposing at the beginning of the movie between England and USA. And we have Lucy, right? The blonde.
Yes, Lucy's the blonde. Yep.
Yes. So we have Lucy in a very proper high school, dancing with her beau, and just, you know, they're doing swing dancing and they're being all proper. And then you have Jude, who's like in a dark nightclub scene in England with his girlfriend, and they're all singing Beatles songs. I think they're going back and forth with the same song at this point. All my loving, I'll give to you. Yeah, but one is more upbeat, dancy, and one is like, oh, more grunge, because that's where Jude is. And it ends up being a story where Jude is in the coal mines and he's like, I got to get out of here. And the reason he's getting out of there is we find out through pictures and story that his mom was impregnated by a soldier from the States, and we don't really know who he is. So Jude is going to go to America and find his dad, daddy issues. So go find dad. And he thinks his dad is – I'm skipping a little. He thinks his dad is a professor at a college, but it turns out he's like the custodial worker at that college. And I was a little disappointed that the dad didn't play further into the film. It's like he met his dad in one scene, and then you don't see the dad again for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I'm like, that was the reason you went to America, and here we are, like, blah, 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 no dad for so long in the film. Did they forget that they
– Dad's just a MacGuffin.
Jude kind of bugs me in a lot of ways, because I feel like he was so mad at his dad because he wanted to tell his dad off, and his dad isn't a professor or anything, but also his dad is just a guy, and so he felt dumb telling him off. And so then he's like, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to go make some new friends and live this crazy lifestyle. And his dad's like, okay, well, you know, you're your own man. And he's like, well, okay then. So I feel like Jude just wasn't I feel like he just needed to just be a little bit more grateful for, you know, the cool dad that he had, because he could have been a big jerk.
Yeah, it could have been could have been pretty crappy. Yeah,
right. In fact, the dad lets him shack up in the little custodial office on campus, which I feel like is against the rules, but that was very kind.
Yeah.
And then in the meantime, Lucy's at home and the boyfriend's going off to war, and then Jude meets Max, the brother of Lucy, at the college, right?
Yes.
And he's a goof off. He's a they're drinking and smoking, but because of the movie rating, they're passing around a doobie that is quite invisible, and yet when Jude sucks in, smoke comes out. And it was on purpose, because if they showed the joint on camera, it could have been rated R, and they did not want that to be the case, which I found that funny. That, I mean, it still got the point across. Plus, this movie directed by Julie Taymor, it had a lot of like imagery like that that was wacko, artistic.
I'm surprised, you know, with all the naked people in this movie, I actually was kind of surprised
that it's PG-13.
It was not R. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I picture it 2007. I'm in the movie theater watching this with my parents.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because my dad loves the Beatles. And so we're like, oh my gosh, of course we'll see Across the Universe. Then I'm watching all these naked girls on the screen with my dad right next to me. And I'm like, oh boy, hope you like it.
It's okay. But,
you know, it's just embarrassing watching a film like this with your parents.
They're naked merladies, so it's okay.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure my parents, being as straight-laced as they can be sometimes, they were like, what is all this weird stuff going on on screen here? What's happening? So the point is, Jude is going to eventually drop out of college, but that's how he meets – or no, wait. Max is going to drop out of college. That's how he meets Jude. Brings him home to Thanksgiving, and that's where he meets Lucy, the sister, who has a boyfriend, but he's going off to war. In the meantime, they just invent a character named Prudence, who's in Ohio, and she is a cheerleader, and she's a lesbian, and they kind of show her for part of the movie and don't really let us know what that's all about.
I wonder what song they're going to center her around.
Yeah, it seems not shoehorned at all, like Jude and Lucy and Prudence all being names that
I think really quick I'll just say I wish, okay, the Dear Prudence sequence was just like, that was like right out. That was just like, okay, her name is Prudence, we know it's going to be Dear Prudence, we know it's coming, and you know she's sad and she's in the closet. And they're like, come out and play, and it was just like shoehorned in. But I think it would have been cool if her name was Prudence and his name was Jude and her name was Lucy and there was JoJo, but then they just didn't play any of those songs. It was just,
ooh,
like, you know, it's just these are them and you recognize them and that's fine. And it's not like the biggest deal. It's not the biggest Easter egg in the world, but it's just like, okay, we're in the world of these Beatles songs, but we don't have to hear those songs because we see these people, you know?
And yeah. I told Roy this on Facebook, that sometimes being too clever is not impressive.
No, yeah. So, and the line specifically that kind of caught me was when she like came into the apartment through the window and he's like, she came in through the bathroom window. Which is a line from a song from Abbey Road, right? And then it's almost like they all turn and look at the camera, right? Like it's, oh, we said the line. Did you guys get that? Did you get it?
Yeah.
And there's several moments. So to answer the earlier question, I think they knew exactly one. I think they mostly knew what songs they wanted in this movie. And then it had to take place in America because 1960s Britain is not as exciting as 1960s America, where the Vietnam War is a thing, right?
Right.
And so I think
it's not as dramatic.
Not as dramatic.
Say. Probably more exciting.
Maybe more exciting. Maybe more fun. But so based off of the songs they wanted to use, the story just writes itself, really. And so I'm not sure how difficult the writing is for this film. And as I'm looking at the soundtrack, like I think it would have been really cool to have had a couple really deep cut songs. But there really aren't any. Maybe the most deep cut song is Blue Jay Way. But I feel like most people, when they hear it, probably still recognize it.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you guys are more the Beatles guy. I mean, I will say the Beatles had a lot of songs. I know that because I was taking notes for this and I took a lot of great notes for this movie. I actually took twice as many notes for Across the Universe as I usually take. I took two full pages. Usually I take one full page of notes when I did it. But after, when the movie ended, I looked down at my notes and I realized I didn't take any notes. I just listed every song that I heard in the movie. And it was two pages of songs.
So when you look at the soundtrack credits, it's long. It is, yeah. It's really long. And so I don't know what it costs to get the rights to cover a song. I know it's a lot cheaper than simply playing the song, because I remember the movie with Sean Penn. What was it called? And Michelle Pfeiffer. Man, I Am Sam, right?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right. Those are all Beatles songs. In that.
Yeah, because I listened to the director's commentary, and they're like, well, we wanted to have a bunch of Beatles songs, but that would have been like triple our budget. So instead, we paid for the covers. And so I guess that's cheaper. I'm assuming you still have to pay something.
Yeah, I think you do. Yeah, for some reason, though, covers are much less expensive. Yeah. I've heard that before, too.
Well, right. I don't know if you want to keep summing up. I mean, the story is mostly...
Well, I will say Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix make an appearance in the film as JoJo and Sadie. I will say they go to a circus, and, you know, Prudence was with them in New York. They all moved to New York, and they were all sharing an apartment together. And then they find Prudence in the circus after she ran away. And then we have the Lucy Jude thing, because Lucy's boyfriend dies in Vietnam, and then Max has to go to Vietnam, and then Jude and Lucy, will they, won't they, will they, won't they? They end up on the roof at the end of the movie in a concert that's illegal and based so on a true concert. Yeah.
They go their separate ways because she's like becoming super radical and he can't handle it. So he goes back to London, but then he comes back to the States for, I don't know why. Final
That's correct.
So let me ask, missed opportunity that they never referred to Sadie as sexy Sadie, or proper restraint, or just realizing that 90% of the audience wouldn't get it anyway?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think I liked that. That's what I appreciated, that her name was Sadie, and they never called her sexy Sadie, but they all check her out.
Foxy,
and then
they call her
you
Foxy,
put two and two together, and you get sexy Sadie, and then you think, oh, that's a Beatles song. Oh, endorphin rush from recognizing stuff.
So way better than someone just spitting out the title of a Beatles song as though it's part of their dialogue.
Right, but because they didn't show any restraint in earlier references, it means they probably did have a line like that got cut. So it's not impressive.
Okay. So for me, the bottom line with this movie is I love the Beatles so much. And I think a lot of these songs are done really well. And I think some of them, maybe not so much. So we can do the same thing here. Helter Skelter in this movie, loved it or hated it?
I didn't like Helter Skelter
like
in this movie. Yeah,
I didn't like it. What do you think, Richard?
I hear you writing it down. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Like how I overall think of the movie?
No, the song Helter Skelter.
Helter Skelter. No. I'd say no.
Okay. How about I've Just Seen a Face in the Bowling Alley?
I like that. Even though they were breaking the rules of the bowling alley,
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But
I think I liked it because of that. I think, taking a big swing with the whole idea of sliding down face first in the bowling alley is a whole group. Yeah.
Okay. Come Together. What do you guys think of Come Together?
I don't think I liked Come Together. Is
I
that
didn't
the
like
one,
Come
is
Together
that the one
all.
Where JoJo gets off the bus?
That's part of it, but there's a lot of, he encounters famous people that are also portraying people without homes.
Yeah.
See, Come Together and Helter Skelter, I think they were just a little too, hey, look at me, I'm this song, and you recognize it, and it just it emphasizes it a little too much. Like, get a load of this, we're playing this song. Kind of the vibe I got.
How about
same.
If I Fell in Love with You, sung by Evan Rachel Wood?
I like her voice, and she didn't sing prior to this film, so I think she did a good job there.
Yeah.
This is I'm sorry. This is like one of those times where I can't think of how that song goes. So I'll say I don't have complaints on it.
Okay, so it was just like no instrumentation, just her singing the solo. Okay, so there's not.
Okay. And I think she sang it live. That was one thing I wanted to say too. In Moulin Rouge and Across the Universe, some of the songs were sung as they were filming the movie, and some were pre-recorded tracks. So that's important to bring up.
Oh, that's funny, because like last time, I guess two times times ago. In podcast 89, we discussed a little bit about the recording of Les Miserables and how the songs were sung live in that, and how I didn't think that that worked very well. And I'm surprised to hear that that was the case for these two, because it didn't have this it didn't have the problems Les Miserables did, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Well, and Les Mis was every single song recorded live, whereas Moulin Rouge and Across the Universe were selective which ones they used from the live recordings.
Which in Les Mis it worked brilliantly in Les Mis for certain songs. And then other songs not so great, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. We'll do a couple more. I Am the Walrus by Bono.
I liked it. I liked the setup. It was contrived, but I liked the performance.
Yeah.
I think I enjoyed the respite of just being like, oh, hey, Bono's in this movie now.
And I loved like the big setup that he took him out to Dr. or Mr. Kite's like ranch or whatever, and then he's like, yeah, he doesn't want to meet you, go home. And he just like hopped back on the bus and left, right? Yeah. That was the end of Bono. So
absolutely hilarious.
Leading up to The Benefit of Mr. Kite, sung by Eddie Izzard.
Yeah, I like that.
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
It's okay.
And then finally, well, I'll do two more. Strawberry Fields Forever.
I liked it.
I was super positive on it, because did they sing Strawberry Fields Forever before they mentioned strawberries a million times, because that was the record label that they formed?
Did he already have the idea of strawberries for the record label when he did the song?
I think I did like Strawberry Fields Forever, but I have a bad taste for strawberries because there were so many strawberries
Lots
in the movie.
Of strawberries.
Like, okay, we got the strawberries, yeah.
So did you? And I'm assuming you caught when he was cutting the apple in half for the still life. But anyway, finally, this is the last one I'll do. Revolution. I was not a fan.
No. No.
It's okay. Yeah. It was okay. Only.
It was a little bit okay. This is the thing, and you know, I kind of said kind of around the same thing as ever. I feel like the actors were really good, but I didn't get into them. I didn't really like the characters that much, because I felt like the characters weren't so much characters, but they were, I don't know, like just improv robots. Yeah. Where it's like, how should I feel? What should I do now? Well, tell me what the next song is, and I'll do that.
So this song for me...
That's what Revolution was.
Was the worst example of that in this film, where like they had to sing the song. The song had to go at a certain tempo, and it was like the acting was just like waiting for the song to keep going, right? Like, especially when he had to like keep singing, you know it's going to be all right, you know it's going to be all right. And it's like, maybe cut part of the song so you can keep the scene going. So that was my least favorite.
So the people who were attacking him don't have to wait for their cue to like lunge and miss him.
I lied. Last one, Hey Jude.
I liked it.
Well, I guess you can't go wrong with
he's met by Max back at the States, and Max jumps up and is shouting the Hey Jude part that is shouted in the song itself, and I think it. Yeah. I like it.
Okay, you didn't bring up probably. I think this is pretty good. And it's is the name of the song just "I Want You"?
I want you.
She's so heavy.
I want you so bad. Yeah. She's so heavy. Yeah. I think it's called it's called "I Want You, She's So Heavy." Yeah,
"I Want You" in parentheses, "She's So Heavy," which is a weird Beatles song. That's never been one of my favorite Beatles songs, but the beginning of it, I thought it was pretty great. You know, that's the one where he has to go and pretend to have flat feet to hopefully avoid getting in the draft.
Oh no! They did a great job. I thought
Uncle Sam. Sam reaches. You know, it's this weird paper CG version of Uncle Sam singing to him. Yeah. And then they kind of go into this Pink Floyd sort of, you know, I think it's very obviously like, it's like, let's do a little bit of The Wall right here, because, you know, all the soldiers kind of have the weird masks, kind of like the weird people in The Wall, which is, you know, a weird show. But that was really great, you know, like Uncle Sam singing I Want You. So it changes the meaning of the song. And it's like, and then when they go She's So Heavy, I think they went too far with She's So Heavy, because then all the soldiers have to carry the Statue of Liberty. And they're saying She's So Heavy because, like, okay, we have to carry the problems of the United States. And
was that, you know, too, was that too on the nose?
Yeah, I think they could have done something else. I don't know. I guess it's sort of clever. You know, what else are you going to do? Because it's such a weird song. But anyway, I think it's really good. It's like, I think they, with I Want You, She's So Heavy, they found a kind of a cool concept among all the constraints they're dealing with, because they had to pry a story into all these songs. And so that's why it just didn't seem like a story. There's another part where, and I didn't want to forget this, because when they go to Mr. Kite's, like, farm place, like, I thought that was going to be, like, the second half of the movie, where it's like, okay, they're here now, and they're going to be dealing with life in this commune or doing whatever, and they're going to evolve that way. But then the scene suddenly ends, and they're all just back in New York. And it just seemed to me like, okay, these Beatles songs, as great as they are, they kind of have a little bit of the same story to them, a little bit. And so we kind of have to start the story over, because we have all these songs to sing, and they're better sung in New York than this other place. Yeah.
So I loved the set piece that is The Benefit of Mr. Kite. I think that musical number is great. I think the visuals are great. I think Eddie Izzard is great. But then, like, it ends, and they're like, oh, now we're done, right? And it just feels like, they knew they wanted to get this big, beautiful scene in the movie with this fun song with a great actor singing it, and it really has nothing to do with the film.
Yes.
Except they find out that What's-Her-Head is happy, I guess. They find Prudence again, and she's happy because she's out and she has a love, right? Mm-hmm. But really, it doesn't do anything to further the plot. There's a... I don't know. I guess you could say maybe this is where Lucy is trying to kind of expand Jude's view of like, I don't know, because she's becoming more extreme and she's opening up her mind and she wants him to do the same thing, and he can follow her this far. But then when she gets back to New York and she starts getting into like violent extremism, he can't keep up. Right.
Right.
I'm trying to justify this pretty hard. I really love the scene, but I don't know what it's doing in the movie.
Yeah. I don't know. And again, it's kind of a tease for, you know, hey, you know, as long as this movie is, you know, I think, you know, at 2 hours and 17 minutes or whatever, it kind of justifies going somewhere else other than their tiny little smelly place in New York,
sure,
which, you know, smells. Yeah. and so it was just kind of frustrating, because it's just like, okay, let's diverge a little bit and then just come back because the CD's not over yet.
Well, yeah, you had this opportunity, right? Because they're like, okay, we've explored 1960s East Coast, but you know what? The 1960s were happening on the West Coast. Let's go check that out. But, like, they're just dipping their toes. They don't really explore it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, Across the Universe.
Is that the first time you've ever seen this movie?
I'd never seen it. I had heard bad things about it. But also, I don't know where I heard those bad things, because it's kind of – I don't know what the Rotten Tomatoes is, but it's well-received on IMDb anyway. It's like in the sevens, which is, you know, usually like a really, really solid movie. I think I am a bit disappointed in Across the Universe, because it's got, you know, and I hate to say this, you know, we're kind of giving things away, but it's kind of got an Assassin's Creed vibe to it. Remember how we felt about Assassin's Creed? how we're just like, I, you know, it feels so assignment-y. It's like, okay, you know, you're on assignment to make this movie. Let's just wait till it gets over and we know what you're saying. And we knew your vibe right from the very beginning. And it didn't do this weird thing that, you know, I don't want to praise Moulin Rouge too much, because I just don't know how they did it. I don't know what kind of magic happened. I can't explain why I think Moulin Rouge sucks me in with these characters when it's doing, like, the process is the exact same thing as this movie.
Yeah.
I would say because I watched Moulin Rouge first, but then I'm just realizing now I watched these out of order. I watched Across the Universe first, so never mind about that.
Was this the first time Katie had seen Across the Universe?
Oh gosh, I didn't ask her while we were watching it. Uh-huh. I don't believe she's seen it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure she'd never seen it. Yeah.
Okay. So and the story's really simple. And again, like the music kind of dictates the story, but it's not like it's a bad story, right? Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, right? And then the ending is pretty cheesy. You knew it was going to end up with "All You Need Is Love," but I still loved it. Like that song's a great song, and I don't know. I guess I'm prone to the sentimental stuff, but I thought it was still pretty good. Anyway, so I don't know. And when I think of this movie, I also think about the advice you once gave me on the television show Glee, John. When I asked you if you liked it, and you said, "Well, it's like the radio. If you like the song, then you like the episode, right?" So, so maybe that's part of. That's definitely a large part of this for me, is that I just love almost every single song, and I can sing almost every single song. So, anyway, it's good times. And Richard, do you have any final thoughts on this?
I do. Oops, I do, because the director of this film, Julie Taymor, she was the director on Broadway of The Lion King, which is a great production that everyone seems to love, and the direction, and just the fact that she's making a cartoon into like this live, amazing version of The Lion King. It's cool. And because of that, she directs this film too, and Bono is in this film, and TV Carpio as Prudence is in this film. And you know what they all end up doing a few years after this film?
Oh, let me guess. Is it Spider-Man?
Yeah, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. And so I just think it's so funny that she's a prolific director, and then you have Bono and The Edge doing the music for Turn Off the Dark, and they said, "We want to do a musical, and the only person we want to direct is Julie Taymor." Obviously, they had a relationship. And then TV Carpio played the Spider Queen, and so when I watched Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, I actually met her backstage afterwards, and she was great. The actors were great. The direction was crazy, and as you know, all the accidents that happened with that production, the Spider-Man's falling from the sky and whatnot. Yeah. I just
like
think
many
it's so...
deaths?
Like, no deaths per se, but lots of injury, lots of casualties and injuries, and just it was a cursed production. It was in previews for months and months and months and months, and when it finally opened, it closed shortly thereafter. So it's amazing that I think this film projected her even further upward as like this great director, and how she fell from grace with Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. And so there was a behind-the-scenes story there.
Next time you meet TV Carpio, let her know that I really appreciated her in this movie. Maybe not so much her character or her songs or her scenes, but just I did appreciate her just in general.
Yeah, she's great.
She didn't like her acting or her singing or her song. None of the scenes she was in, but she was good. So,
Her acting was okay.
I will say, speaking of The Lion King, I put off seeing that for the longest time, and then my wife and I did like a New Year's Eve in New York City. And we decided to see a handful of musicals, and we were just told that we would be stupid if we didn't see The Lion King. Because to be honest, I don't love the cartoon. But so when we went and saw The Lion King, I was so blown away. The Lion King is incredible. And that's all I have to say then.
You'll have to see it. I mean, she's very famous for directing that play. And I think, as we've said, it propelled her to stardom, which she didn't live up to.
Yeah. She Peter principled because of Peter Parker.
Yes.
Very nice. Very nice.
There's your tagline, John. So anyway.
I was just about to write that down. Well, we have to talk about this. What are the Beatles songs there were 100 Beatles songs in this movie. but which ones would you have liked to have seen acted out in a scene?
That they didn't include?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much, I guess, what are your favorite Beatles songs that they didn't have, I guess, is the question.
So my current favorite is I've Just Seen a Face, and I think they did a pretty good job. Across the Universe is way, way up there. Let It Be is way up there, and they've done all those right. So I don't know. Maybe The End from Abbey Road could have been good. I don't know how they would have done that. Maybe as their relationship was breaking up. I don't know. it's hard. I don't know. I mean, any thoughts from either of you?
I think they really needed to do a sequence where they're all evicted, and the only thing, you know, they find a bunch of, they find an old school bus that has a boat motor on it, and they they ride in a boat, and then it sinks, and then they sing "We All Live in a Yellow Submarine." But then their landlord is like, "Oh, hey, I found your check," and then they move back into their house.
There you go.
So they could do that.
They played some like early 60s Beatles songs, right? So it wasn't all like revolutionary Vietnam War era music. So I think it would have been fun if they could have found a way to use Twist and Shout organically. That's a big one.
They kind of generally, well, not, I mean, because it kind of started with the early Beatles sound anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, more or less, it kind of seemed like they went in semi-chronological order, because the end of the movie was a little bit more, you know, like kind of on the verge of breakup. Okay, well.
Can't Buy Me Love, maybe?
Okay.
We Can Work It Out. I'm sorry, I'm just naming Beatles songs at this point, but We Can Work It Out maybe would have been good. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I think Norwegian Wood would have really infused just a little bit of non-bombast. Just a little bit, you know, I don't know how you can hear that song and not, you know, consider the sincerity of it all, you know. And I think that would have really grounded the movie.
That's good. I think as far as like quieter, sincere Beatles songs, I think the song I Will is way up there, one of my very, very favorites. I'm also shocked that they didn't use the song Yesterday just out of obligation. But anyway.
They were like, oh, well, in 10 years from now, we can just reserve this song and just call that the movie. The next movie, next Beatles movie with a bunch of Beatles songs in it.
All right. Well, okay. Any other questions about Across the Universe? You guys ready to do Dear Evan Hansen?
I kind of am ready.
Do it. Okay.
So this movie's fascinating, and I didn't really know anything about it, except I think my kids liked the Sam Smith cover of You Are Not Alone? That's not what it's called. What's the name of that song?
It's You Will Be Found.
You Will Be Found. Okay. Yeah.
You Are Not Alone, the Michael Jackson song?
So I didn't know much about it other than that. I mean, the previews looked good, and then the critical reviews came out, and I didn't see it because I'm like, well, this movie is a bomb. But so I noticed when I look at Rotten Tomatoes, the critics gave it like 30-something percent, or maybe even lower. I don't know. It was really low. But the audience reaction was like 88%. So there's a pretty big discrepancy there. Anyway, let's talk about it. Dear Evan Hansen is a movie about a young man who's got who's dealing with some emotional issues. He's medicated for some problems. He's got a therapist, and his therapist tells him to write letters to himself every day. So he writes letters to Dear Evan Hansen every day to kind of give himself a pep talk. He goes to school. He doesn't really have any friends. He's got one friend. Is the guy's name Jared? That's not right.
Yeah, it's Jared, yeah.
Jared, okay. So he's got a friend named Jared, right? And Jared, though, says, I'm only your friend through family. So I guess he's forced to be his friend because they have some sort of family relationship. There's a girl he likes. Her name is Chloe. She doesn't really know him, although she does, you know, she acknowledges him and she tries to talk to him, and he just can't handle the anxieties too much. And then there's the school.
It's Zoe, isn't it?
Yeah, what did I say? Did I say Chloe?
Yeah.
Apologies. It's Zoe. Zoe's got some killer Vans, too, that she shows off later in the movie. Yeah. So. But Zoe's brother is a guy named Connor, and he's kind of, I mean, the jocks pick on him and point out that he's dressed like the next school shooter, right? And he's kind of got that vibe, paints his nails black, doesn't really, you know, I think Evan, in a moment where he kind of wants to stand up for Connor, and Connor misinterprets it and yells at him. Anyway, Connor later meets him in the library when Evan is printing out one of his letters to himself. And Connor sort of tries to make friends. He writes his name on Evan's cast, but he pulls the page off the printer and he takes it the wrong way. He's like, did you want me to see this? Why are you talking about my sister? And were you hoping I'd yell at you so everyone can say, there goes that freak again? Right? He gets really upset.
Wait, does he want to make friends?
He's being genial, isn't he? I don't think he's being mean.
I thought he was being mean.
You thought he was picking on Evan?
I thought he was picking on him by signing his cast like the way he did and just covering the whole cast.
I think he was being pushy because I don't think Evan wanted the attention, but I didn't get the vibe that he was trying to be mean or cruel about it. I mean, you could be right. Richard, your take, sir?
I'm going to say that he, socially, Connor doesn't fit in well with the rest of the school. And so in his own way, that was probably trying to be nice, but it came off very aggro-aggressive.
Like, very aggressive, yeah.
I think I might be a really big jerk here because I kind of think that's a nice way of saying Connor is the villain of the movie.
Well, so I think because that's like the part of the movie where he paints this beautiful picture of Connor, but in the back of our heads, we're like, we have no proof of that at all, right? Mm-hmm. As far as we know, everyone's memory of Connor is that he's really bad, and only until the very end where you get that scene of him playing guitar in rehab do you get like, oh, okay, this is Connor when he's comfortable kind of sharing himself with other people, and maybe he's not all that bad, because the truth is almost no one is all that bad, right? So people just have problems. But anyway, the point is, Connor storms
Hitler
off.
Painted.
Hitler painted. So when I say almost everyone, Hitler's the exception. I don't think we should have to talk about it, right? So, but Connor storms off. We don't see him for a couple of days. Evan's called into the principal's office, and Connor's parents are there, and they relate to him that Connor has taken his life, but they found in his possession the letter to Dear Evan. And so the mother insists, like, oh, you guys are friends. You must be really close friends because this letter says my only friend, right? And he's trying to tell them no, like he didn't write that. And he's trying to tell them, but the two parents start arguing with each other, and the mother is so distraught, and these parents are fighting that he's just so trapped and uncomfortable that the only way he can kind of get through this and to try to relieve, I guess, the mother. This is my take on it, that the mother is so distraught that he's just trying to give something. And so then he kind of lies, right? He says, oh, yeah, Connor and I were friends, and he was a good guy. They invite him to their house where he's going to tell them the truth. It kind of repeats, and instead of coming clean with the truth, he gets deeper into the lie. So one of the complaints I heard about this movie is that it's improbable. And I guess, but I don't know why that's ever like a great critique of a movie, that the plot is improbable. Why are we going to the movies, right, if we're not going to see something that stretches the imagination a little bit? But I also completely understand the pressure that could cause you to tell a lie. And then once you're in a lie, like, there's two paths, right? And yeah. The harder path is coming clean, and the easier path is just to get out of control, which never turns out great vis-a-vis this movie, right? So anyway, it just keeps moving along that he lies about being friends with Connor. This family keeps inviting him over. He's feeling loved. He's feeling accepted. His mom isn't around, but it's not really her fault. His father ran off. It doesn't pay any attention to their family. So the mom has to support the family, and so she has to work long hours. But he's kind of become a surrogate son to this very wealthy family with Amy Adams, and I don't know who the actor is that plays the father. By the way, the father initially, you think he's a big jerk, but I think I really feel for the father, right? Like, he really had early on this bond with Connor before Connor just kind of things started turning sour for Connor, right? Whatever reason that is.
And then, it's a little – you always talk about this that I always found fascinating because I never understood it. The strife that comes from a death in the family and just the different ways – that they try to cope and help each other out, and they're just different from each other in that you know, the more tension causing of trying to do good in that grieving process.
Yeah, I have mentioned this before. So like a marriage surviving the death of a child, you've got like a 6% chance, which seems really low, right? You would think, oh, two people who love each other can get through the death of a child, but it's almost a guaranteed divorce because people grieve differently, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, the climax then is that he's asked to give this talk by the student body president, who we learn also has serious emotional issues that she's medicated for. And that's one of the messages of this movie that I really love, which is you look around and everyone looks like they're really successful and doing great, but everyone is struggling. Everyone hurts. High school sucks, right? I mean, I think we had fun in high school, John, but also high school was the worst time of my life. So, I love that the student body president comes out and she exposes herself and we kind of get that message. It's okay to struggle because everyone's struggling. And then he has to give a speech at this assembly for Connor. And of course, that's where the big famous song comes, right? He fumbles with his cards. He ends up giving this speech, and of course, in song form because it's a musical. And his speech goes crazy viral, and it just kind of explodes. And now it's like there's no turning back. Now there's nothing he can possibly do to turn back. And then the student body president, thinking that she can help even further, she releases the letter that everyone assumed was like the pre-suicide letter from Connor, and it just backfires spectacularly. They're trying to raise money to preserve an orchard in Connor's name, and it just like it is a horrible decision. And now everyone is trashing the family, and the family's having trouble again. And Evan admits the truth. And I missed an important scene, but we'll come back to it in the awards. Anyway, he admits the truth, and you kind of think at this point that he's going to have a really rough time. But in the end, the girl he likes and has come to like fall in love with him, they're going to be together, and the family's going to reaccept him. But that doesn't really happen, right? So he doesn't like he kind of parts ways with the girl, and you don't get the sense that he's reestablished a relationship with his family that he got in so tight with. But the important part is that he has a major step forward with his mother, right? Like there's some serious healing between him and his mother, where he admits to his mother that a time when she thought he simply fell out of a tree, that he was trying to take his life. And when he admits that to her, he thinks that it's over now because she's going to hate me because she sees what an awful broken person I am. But that's not what happens. The opposite happens. And that's the relationship that is healed at this part in the movie. Anyway, I don't know if you can tell, I feel really emotionally linked to this movie. I don't know if that makes sense. This movie really struck me. It really hit me.
Okay.
So I will say, because again, like everyone struggles and you look around at your friends and your students and you think everyone's doing fine, right? But speaking as a person who as a teenager had suicidal thoughts and dealt with depression, and speaking as a father who has children who have had suicidal thoughts and depression, like this was a very impactful film for me. And so I can see that I might be biased because it touches a part of me, right, that is important to my life. But I don't really understand how it could have been disliked so much by critics. I understand that the main actor is about 50 years old. I think we've seen older people pretend to be high school students before, like Jason Robards.
The cane was a bit much. Yeah. Like Jason Robards. No, that's good. But, Jason Robards.
So, the complaints, and I'm taking this off of Rotten Tomatoes, always has their summary, right? Like, I think the summary was reaches the emotional heartbeat of the stage production, but poor casting choices and unbelievable plot. And like, unbelievable plot, I don't agree with that.
I want to say the opposite of what you just said, because I actually did write this down. Okay, and I've never seen the stage production.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't think I took to this movie as much as you did, but I totally get what you're saying. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, you know what? If I saw this on the stage in the intimacy of a room full of people and I saw him singing these songs about these issues, I think I totally understand why Dear Evan Hansen is like this big theater sensation, not so much a cinematic sensation. I can't really put my fingers on it, but I kind of think this would be so much more amazing emotionally. Oh. In a room full of people watching it as a play. And I 100%. Think that might be what people are responding to. You know?
So is it a letdown factor? But that doesn't make sense, because I think there was a letdown factor with Les Mis, which is incredible on the stage, and you had the inevitable letdown on the movie screen, but that was like, what did it get, like 70-something on Rotten Tomatoes? And then Dear Evan Hansen is like 28.
It's the type of movie, though. I think, you know, and I don't know if every one of those critics saw the stage play, but yeah. It just seems like this type of music is just it's
suited
the intimacy
for a theater,
factor, you know? Yeah, it's for not suited for a theater. It's too impersonal in the theater. It has to have the personality of the stage for it to work, like for it to work as best as it could. Yeah. Anyway,
so I will say, like, I love Ben Platt, and I mean, after a while, I kind of was able to stop thinking to myself like that he he's about the same age as Fred Armisen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I will say, because I know that we've got Wicked is coming out in 1 or 2 years, and I think Ariana Grande is Glinda, and I don't know the name of the girl who's playing Elphaba, but I remember hearing in an interview a couple years ago where Idina Menzel was upset that they would consider anyone other than her, and I'm like, aren't you like 45 or 50 at this point? Like,
yeah.
You may be past the point where you can pull off a high school girl in Oz, okay? but anyway, like the complaints that I saw from the critics, I don't have those complaints at all. And,
right.
And I found this movie pretty powerful. I would love to see this on the stage. I agree with you, John. I think this story would be significantly better presented as a stage production, which I'm sure Richard can speak to.
I can speak to it. Yeah, you both should see it on stage. I think, unfortunately, the backlash that both the musical and the movie have received are a little bit, like you say, unfair. And it's sad that and I think it happens in the year 2021, 2022, where we have social media and TikTok and just instant like critics. Like even before the movie came out, you had the trailer of Ben Platt, and he is 27 in the film playing a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
And everyone was ruthless with their criticism there, where he kind of had to slap back and say, what about, you know, in Greece when they were all 30-year-old people playing high schoolers? No one complained about that. But
or Charisma Carpenter in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She was 28, right?
Yeah.
So, but
typically, everyone plays older or younger when they're older. Yeah.
He sang it originally on Broadway, right?
Yes, and that was another appeal, too. If you cast the original Evan Hansen, you might sell more tickets or, you know, sell more DVDs because he is a big draw. His voice is very unique. He's intrinsically connected to the role of Evan Hansen. Not that he's the only one that can do it, but his dad is a producer on the movie. And then also the director of the movie who wrote The Perks of Being a Wallflower saw the musical and thought, well, I have to cast Ben Platt because he is Evan Hansen to me. And so you kind of get the idea that it was hard for them to like tear their expectation apart from Ben Platt, which I think is fair and I think it's okay, but I can see why people didn't like it. But it's sad that that drowns out the impact of the film. The musical itself, after I saw it, it became wildly successful, and then now there are more critics to the musical too. I saw it in previews at the Arena Stage Theater in DC in 2015, and no one knew what Dear Evan Hansen was when I went to see it, which I felt like we were getting a sneak peek to something that was going to get majorly big. And it was true. We were like, oh my gosh, your show's going to Broadway. This was amazing. And they're like, what? No, don't jinx it. And we're like, no, you guys are great. Like, we saw Ben Platt, we saw Laura Dreyfus and the rest of the cast. And we were like, you guys are really solid. And then it did transfer to Broadway, and then it got, you know, great reviews, and it got big box office returns. But also, they, you know, later in life, they're like, wait a minute. Is the hero of this story a liar, like a compulsive liar? And I'm like, yeah, but isn't that okay? Like what you said, does the story suffer because all the characters are flawed, or does that make it more realistic or less realistic? I don't know why people are harping on it so badly. They're just, they hate that Evan Hansen lied about Connor and knowing him. They hate that there was this whole deception. And I'm like, this happens in real life.
Yeah.
One of the composers and lyricists, Ben Pasek and Paul did the music and lyrics. But Ben Pasek said that this really happened in his high school. So it's like based in reality. It's people lie all the time.
Yeah.
I had someone in my junior high that passed away. And there was kind of like this impulse to be like, I didn't know her, but I feel really sad that she's gone, and then you kind of regret not knowing her better. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
This is so weird. Okay, let me just say, I didn't like this movie that much, but I like it a lot more, and the reason I like it more is because I have so much spite for these weird critiques that I'm hearing about it, because I think that's crazy. I never understood the concept of a protagonist who has no flaws. That's just so strange to me. And I guess one of the critiques is that he doesn't get punished enough for lying, but I mean, it's not, the lie isn't glorified. I mean, this guy has this anxiety disorder and he's dealing with his anxiety the whole movie. I mean, it's not like he's having this great time. I mean, he's got the burden of it the whole time. So I don't know what the problem is.
I feel like his punishment happens throughout the film, right? Right. Yeah. As he's enduring this lie. And again, to Richard's point, like, who on earth has not found themselves caught in a lie that they didn't know how to back out of? Right. It happens to all of us. And this one just happens to be like horribly public, right? Like crazy public. But and then you've got a person who like isn't really equipped to deal with the situation emotionally at all. And so he gets sucked into this terrible situation that he can't hardly handle. And then so I did see that at the end. I'm like, OK, here comes the enormous backlash. And instead it's like, well, people stop waving to him at school and then we move on. And I kind of okay with that. I don't need him to be like horribly, horribly punished by his peers. And then like in the end, there's some miraculous rescue from the girl who decides that she once again loves him. So,
right.
And I also think that maybe this movie, because we had 13 Reasons Why, which tried to deal with really hard issues, but maybe was a little ham-fisted and was kind of like also critiqued very heavily. Right. And I think that this is sort of in the same vein, but I think this does it much better. This handles these difficult topics much better than 13 Reasons Why.
I think I really like, again, and this is a little bit going back to Moulin Rouge, there's a little bit of the miraculous just magic moments and magic plot factors and just elegance of, you know, musicals and, you know, where it's like, okay, it's this one act and this one act saves the day. But then after the act, it's okay. You know what? That's miraculous and it's wonderful that we have these kind of moments in musicals, but we're also going to deal with it in the real world as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So one thing I think this movie suffers from, that it's unfortunate when this happens in musicals. I know like the big number is it You Will Be Found? At some point I'm going to remember the name of that song. Right. But I think like the opening number is so incredible. Like the opening number just really grabs you and it may be the best number in the whole movie. and it ends in the first 5 minutes, right?
Yeah. That number originally is like the second song in the musical, but it is the classic protagonist I want song, you know.
Yeah.
In every musical you have them, you know, this is what I want, this is what I need, but no, that's the biggest hit from that, and You Will Be Found are the two big hits there everyone sings.
Strangely, neither will be chosen as my favorite song, but anyway,
we'll I was just gonna say the original opening was the two mothers in the show, Evan Hansen's mom and Connor's mom, singing a song that's like, does anybody have a map? Does anybody know what the hell they're looking for? Because moms don't know what they're doing. There's no roadmap to motherhood. And it is a good opening to the show, and it relates to both kids or both families. And they cut it from the film, I think, because Julianne Moore is not a strong singer. So they're like, we'll just skip to the big hit, which...
She's also a doctor who hates kids. Sorry.
She's a doctor who hates kids.
Appearance in The Fugitive, yeah.
Yeah, just happens to be the same character, I would say.
Yeah.
So it kind of suffers with some of the cuts that they had to do, because I think we would feel more for the parents in the show.
And that's too bad.
Yeah.
Because I would say, like, being a teenager is really, really hard. And when you're a teenager, you think you know how you would like your parents to handle the situation so that when you become a parent, you can do it right. But then I would say being a parent of teenagers is really, really hard. And the things that you thought you were going to do to be a parent for teenagers doesn't work and it doesn't apply. And a parent of teenagers, you just constantly feel lost, just hoping, like, that the next day is going to be a little better. And so I really feel for, I think Amy Adams does a pretty darn good job in this movie. I really feel for her character as well as Julianne Moore. And like, anyway, we'll get there. I've got the scene I want to talk about in the awards I've kind of glossed over, but we'll get there. In fact, we can get there as soon as you guys are ready, because I'm starting to have people wander into the room looking at me like, why are you still down
here?
So.
I have one more thing to say about Dear Evan Hansen, and that's I realized toward the end that this is actually the same plot as the Robin Williams movie World's Greatest Dad. Have you guys ever heard of that movie or seen it?
I've heard of it.
I haven't, no.
I love it. It's a kind of a comedy, but it's just bleak and dark, and it like kind of goes too far in a lot of ways, maybe crosses the line in a lot of ways. But it's actually – the story is he has a son who just has some serious problems and is a bit – yeah, and you know, kind of, I don't know, I'll just say this, you know, I wouldn't be friends with this kid, right? and the son kills himself, and then the dad, who teaches at the same school, who's an aspiring writer as well, writes the son's, suicide note and kind of writes from the grave from his son and kind of gets fame. You know, because he is a really good writer, but he actually has to use his son's death to get fame. it's interesting.
Interestingly, I think that the part of this movie that I liked the least, when it was kind of like the goofy let's invent emails montage, right? Where it kind of just gets kind of silly, where like we have to make up all these emails. But anyway, I didn't struggle with that too much.
Right. I mean, and I said this to you before on Facebook, that there was more levity to the musical because you have a live audience that's laughing at a lot of the jokes live. Like when he first runs into Zoe and he's like, hey, Zoe, no, I know your name is Zoe. And he's being really awkward, and it's played dramatically in the film. In real life, like watching that on stage, you're laughing. You're laughing at him because he's kind of like suffering through the anxiety and failing and saying, no, I mean, this is what I meant. And then she's like, okay. And you're laughing as an audience that you can't really get when you're watching a film. So it just turns out to be kind of cringy and awkward, which is realistic, but it's not always, you know, the same, like you said, watching it in the audience on a stage. One last thing I forgot that I wanted to say is, leading up to it, we talked about Moulin Rouge and Across the Universe had some live singing. Ben Platt sang all of his songs live on set. So that's all live music.
Oh, okay.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
That is an oh wow, but also so strange, because he especially sounded so strange to me. Like, it sounded off.
Well, he has a unique voice. I wouldn't say he's like someone that sings just like every other male on Broadway. He has that vibrato and he has that style that's different. So I think that's why they were like, you better sing live so we can capture that idea of what people saw live.
So that's interesting, because there were like a couple moments and a couple songs where I thought they're recording this live, because his performance and delivery is very emotional, but it's not necessarily like perfect.
Right.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah, so if it goes off pitch or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I bring one more thing up?
Just one more, though.
Yeah, all that's
right.
Your limit.
This is my last thing. And I don't even know what I want to say about this, but I did find it kind of interesting, and I don't know how much truth is in this or if this is like something the movie got wrong. But I found it interesting that Evan Hansen is just debilitated by his anxieties and his fears, and he can't do anything, and he isn't able to reach out. He's not able to kind of perform at life at all. And the person who kind of sees that and recognizes, you know, whatever, you know, emotional disabilities he has, is someone else with emotional disabilities. And that is what's her name? Alana, the class president, who reveals that, yes, she is just like him. Whereas I feel like it's kind of implied that her insecurities and her emotional illnesses are the ones that actually, those are the things that actually propel her to succeed, because she's insecure to do it otherwise. And I don't know if they made that statement on purpose or if that's even accurate at all, but I just found it interesting.
So I think it's both accurate and on purpose, right? That some people are fueled by their insecurities, and some people are absolutely trapped. And I think it was nice to see the breadth. And I think because you have Evan Hansen and you're like, well, obviously he's a messed up guy. He's got all these problems. But then you need to see that here's the most successful person in the high school, and she also has serious problems.
Right.
Right. And people deal with and cope with their problems differently. She's able to make hers work in the positive way. And he is barely functional. So I think that it's both accurate and intentional.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. Good to know. I was right.
So here's the deal, John. I need you, sir. We're going to go to commercial break and you're going to lay down all the information that everyone needs to further enjoy this podcast. And while you're doing that, I'm going to figure out what my kids are eating for dinner. So I'll be right back.
Contact info, everybody. Go ahead and send us an email. We check it monthly. And that email is yoursmindtheirspodcast@gmail.com. Send something to us. We will read it on the air, even if it doesn't represent our own political beliefs. Go ahead and find us on the blog, yoursmindtheirspodcast.blogspot.com. And from there, you can just have direct download to every single MP3 that we've done. We've done 90 other of these, and there are 3 movies in each of those, so you do the math. It's a lot of movies. So if you're listening to this for the first time, say, and you're like, I haven't even seen these movies, I don't even know what they're talking about, go back and find one where you've seen all 3 movies. I guarantee you'll have a super, super, super great time. Also, we try to make it fun even if you haven't seen the movies, but hey, you know what? We're also only human. Go ahead and go to iTunes or whatever iTunes is called now. I believe it's called Apple Podcasts. Go there, give us 5 stars out of 5, and be sure to leave an enlightening review of whatever you want to say. It could be that weird political belief thing that I mentioned earlier. You could say that in your review. That's totally fine. Let's see. And the Facebook group is a great place to go. So if you go onto Facebook and search for Yours, Mine, and Theirs, you can join our group or you can lurk on the group or whatever. I'm pretty sure it's pretty open. But that's actually, you know, where you have your most options. As you know, we choose the movies we watch and we choose the genres of movies we watch based on your input. And so you can force us to watch a specific type of movie or a specific movie. That is in your hands through the polls that we do on Facebook. Also, we keep a lot of movie notes on there. So it's pretty much like reading a podcast, live as we watch movies, and specifically as Roy watches movies. Plus, you meet great people like Richard on there, and everybody is super nice. So far, anyway. So be one of those nice people. Our number, our phone number, leave us a voicemail, 801-896-4542. That's 801-896-4542. And that is contact information.
Okay, all right. You guys ready to do some awards? Let's get through
these. Let's do it.
All right. Okay, Richard, let's start with you. Your favorite title of all these movies?
My favorite title is the one in French. So it's Moulin Rouge.
Very good. John, what do you think?
I don't speak French. I went with Across the Universe because, I don't know, it seems really big.
It does. So I think Across the Universe, they're like, well, let's pick the name of a famous Beatles song, and that's the name of the movie. So I went with Dear Evan Hansen.
Whoa. Those are my favorite awards when it splits three ways like that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, best movie poster, John.
Well, the Moulin Rouge, by the way, they're all the same poster. They all have the same color scheme. But the Moulin Rouge one has, it's got the really dark, and it's got the splash of red on Nicole Kidman, and it's gorgeous, I think.
What do you think, Mr. Tessman?
I did the same. Yeah, I said Moulin Rouge.
You're both wrong. It's Across the Universe. Okay.
Oh, okay. I like the strawberry, but we talked to death about strawberries, too.
I love strawberries. Okay, so best tagline. Richard, let's hear your real one and then your 3 substitutions.
Okay, I was split. I'm going to pick All You Need Is Love from Across the Universe, but there was also a tagline from Moulin Rouge that nothing matters but love. So that's basically the same tagline. So
it's pretty close.
You could go either way. But Moulin Rouge, the new tagline is Love is Sad. Across the Universe is Across the Universe is it's better with weed. I think it definitely would enhance a lot of the visuals. Okay. And then Dear Evan Hansen is you could think of it like Never Been Kissed, where Drew Barrymore goes back to high school.
Okay. All right, John, what's your favorite tagline?
My favorite tagline is just the entire Evan Hansen letter just written out on the poster. The answer is simple. Volume. Volume of words in the tagline.
Oh, very good. So, okay. Yeah. Well, I went with Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic. Or, I'm sorry, Truth, Beauty, Freedom, Love. I counted that as a tagline.
That's good.
But John, what are your replacements?
I want my Moulin Rouge tagline to be Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic. Oh, dang. Okay. My replacement taglines for Moulin Rouge: this movie is about truth, beauty, freedom, and above all those things, love. But about most of all, death by consumption. My Across the Universe tag: I once knew a girl, or should I say, she once knew me.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, my Dear Evan Hansen tag is: Dear Evan Hansen, you're great. Love, Victor.
Oh, I love that.
I've never seen Love, Victor, but I just, yeah. I got it. I was saying, oh, we're watching Love, Victor? Oh, no, wait, we're watching Dear Evan Hansen. I got the two shows mixed up because, like, one's the beginning of a letter and one's the end. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
All right. Well, my replacements are Moulin Rouge, Blood, Sugar, Sex, Fake Orgasms. Let's see. Across the Universe, Pools of Sorrow, Waves of Joy. Dear Evan Hansen, you'll feel just like a 30-year-old kid again.
Yeah.
All right. Richard, your favorite opening credits?
I like Moulin Rouge because of the orchestral introduction.
Yeah, John, what do you
think? What is that called? Yeah.
The conductor doing the most conducting that's ever been conducted. I mean, are those real conductors? At one point, he, like, kicks his leg up to conduct the orchestra. No, opening credits, Moulin Rouge with, you know, the thing in the old school, like the Lumiere film.
Yeah.
Scrolling by. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's Moulin Rouge. Okay. John, your favorite titular line?
My favorite titular line is when Nicole Kidman says, "I'm going away from you, away from the Duke, away from the Moulin Rouge."
Well, that's very dramatic. Richard, what's your favorite?
Yeah.
I have Harold Zeidler doing, "It's the Moulin Rouge!"
Okay, I went with, "And tonight, Mr. Kite is topping the bill, baby. Across the universe, it's me."
Good.
Yay. Okay, favorite technology, Richard?
It was split between that pulley system that Toulouse fell down during the play.
Yeah.
But also Across the Universe, where they're filming in slow motion, but they're singing at normal speed. I thought that was good technology.
Ooh.
Oh,
hey, John, what do you think?
Okay. Harold Zeidler had this paper dance counter, like, in front of the stage, and he turned a crank and it said, "Okay, now everybody dance to the Hunkadoola," and it just kind of told people what to dance to. That's the tech. Yeah.
That's pretty good. So from Across the Universe, I went with the super watery waterbed, like the transparent waterbed. Like, if you're ever going to waterbed, the transparent waterbed, that's the one.
Yeah, that's good.
All right, John, what's your favorite name?
Favorite name is the guy who saves Satine when she falls. His name is Le Chocolat.
Yeah. Chocolate saved the day.
Chocolate, yeah.
All right, what about you, Richard?
I have Henry Marie Raymond de Toulouse-Lautrec Monfa.
Very good. I have Mon Fromage, which I think means cheese boy or cheese child or something.
So we like all the French, I think.
Yeah. Well, all right. Your favorite food, Richard?
So, well, grab ice cream at a la mode. You know, that one.
Very good. What about you, John?
The Thanksgiving dinner that Lucy's family has with Jude in tow, and I was, like, really annoyed that Jude just didn't seem to appreciate the Thanksgiving dinner at all.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I'm going with sexy Jell-O from Moulin Rouge.
Was that the Jell-O in the mold, in the busty mold?
The busty mold Jell-O, yep.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Well, favorite outfit, John?
Favorite outfit? Well, it had to be when Christian goes to meet Satine and she thinks she's supposed to seduce him as the Duke, and she wears this black number with this corset and clear cape and garters and hello.
Hello. Okay, what about you, Richard?
I picked the diamond necklace that Satine wore in her opening number. It was apparently the most expensive costume piece of that time.
Okay.
I went for the most expensive costume.
So I loved everything that Mr. Zidler wore. Well, I guess I'll go with his opening number get up. He was decked out, that one. Okay. All right, then, your favorite alien, Richard.
I said Christian because he came from England.
That's true. Oh, that's true. John, what do you think?
Christian because he came from England. Yes.
Oh, I went with the mer people from across the universe. I don't know where they're from.
Actual aliens.
Yeah. Okay. All right, then, Jonathan, your favorite special effects.
Favorite special effects. It's when Zidler is trying to talk to the Duke, trying to convince him of something, and he just kind of goes in fast motion sometimes around the Duke, and he's like,
oh, yeah.
And he just moves around, and he's just this big weird guy. So it's really funny to see him go in fast motion, and the fast motion sound effects.
I picked whatever they used to de-age Ben Platt, whether it be makeup or CGI. I thought, you know, they did their best.
They did their best. All right, my favorite special effects is just, I guess, like the whole crazy sequence at Mr. Kite's place. So, lots of stuff going on. Anyway, okay, what about your favorite location, Richard?
I had to pick the Moulin Rouge in Paris, but as filmed in that Australian studio, because they never did any on-location filming.
Right. I think the entirety of Moulin Rouge was filmed indoors, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go just down the road, just the small village of Montmartre, just pretty much Christian's apartment building that he's in. Mm.
Well, from across the universe, I'd like to catch lunch in the Psychedelicatessen.
Ah, Psychedelicatessen. That's good. Yeah, okay.
I bet they've got a groovy Reuben there. Yeah. All right, John, what is your favorite song from these films?
Okay, a few more songs are going to creep up and make appearances. So I think probably just because it didn't work for you, I think I might go with Roxanne in Moulin Rouge. What put it over the top, again, is Ewan McGregor's part, you know, it's more than I can stand. And then he goes into a separate part, apart from the song.
Mm. Okay, very good. What about you, Richard? Your favorite song?
I think it's an anthem for this generation found in Dear Evan Hansen. Even when the dark comes crashing through, if you have a friend to carry you, when you're broken and something, you will be found. That one.
It's great.
Broken on the ground, you will be found. I figured it out.
So I chose from Dear Evan Hansen, and I went with the anonymous ones as sung by our student body president.
Yeah, she helped write that. She helped write that for the movie. It wasn't in the original musical.
Oh, wow.
So Amandla Stenberg wrote that with the creators.
Wow. Well done, young lady. Okay, what about your favorite guest star, Richard?
Eddie Izzard.
Oh, yeah, he's great, isn't he? In his 5 minutes or less. All right, John, what about you?
Okay, and across the universe, the bum on the street who sings a little bit of the song, Joe Cocker, who made, with a little help from my friends, like his version, you know, was very unique, and he didn't sing that song, but he sang a different song, so it was kind of fun to see him.
Get Back? No, not Get Back. Come Together?
I think it was Come Together, yeah.
Joe Cocker was the homeless guy?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty good guess. I just went with Nikki Domain, who plays Jared Kalwani, who's Evan's family friend.
Yeah, we like him.
We like him. Yeah. Okay.
And they made him gay in this movie where he wasn't gay in the original. So I like that too.
Okay. Is the actor gay? I feel like more gay parts should actually be played by gay actors, but
I feel the same way. You're preaching to the choir.
Mm. All right, then, friends. What about your favorite external recurring character?
Me?
We'll go Richard first.
Okay.
We've seen them in a film before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think we alluded to this then, that Julianne Moore was that nurse doctor from The Fugitive, and she's still working at the hospital and still doing her shtick with her son. Right. Yeah.
That's she's now a nurse, not a doctor.
Yeah, I think she was demoted from that whole debacle. Yeah.
For saving that kid's life.
Or she went back to school. She went back to nursing school.
There you go.
Now she's a nurse. Okay, I'm going to go with Kylie Minogue, who plays the Green Fairy, the Green Absinthe Fairy. She, of course, was Jean-Claude Van Damme's right-hand lady in Street Fighter.
Oh, my goodness.
There you go.
That's crazy. So I didn't go with the character. I went with sexy couch painting from both Titanic and Across the Universe.
Oh, couch painting. Yes, I must sketch you.
Like,
yes.
It's almost identical, right?
Yeah.
All right. So I bet that was a fun scene with your parents, Richard.
Yeah. I just remember feeling more awkward. So this time around, watching it was a much better viewing experience.
All right. Internal recurring character then, Jonathan.
All right. I'm going to go Bono. He made his appearance, you know, on the bus and Across the Universe, and then they sang In the Name of Love in Moulin Rouge.
Oh, very good. Okay, what about you? Mine is similar. What about you, Richard?
Yeah, mine is kind of a cop-out. It's just going to be Love, since I felt like Love was intertwined in all three films, because All You Need is Love. Love is the greatest. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going specifically with All You Need is Love, sung in both Moulin Rouge and Across the Universe.
Yay!
Yay for love. Okay, the best death. Just the one that just made you so happy, Richard.
Oh, that made me happy?
I don't know. The best death.
I'd say the best death was Satine.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I agree with that. I think it was, a lot weighs on that death. It was a pretty big death. One of the all-time cinematic deaths, I would say. And you know what? And I was it's just kind of weird, because it could have been this great, wonderful, uplifting movie. I feel like they didn't have to have the death, but the death kind of adds a little bit, I think.
Doesn't that just kill you? It's the Romeo and Juliet moment, right? Where everything is finally worked out perfectly, and then they just steal it from you.
Yeah, just stolen. Just stolen.
All right. So, and I didn't talk about this when we were talking about Moulin Rouge, but one of the reasons I really love Moulin Rouge is because I feel like love should feel like a miracle, right? It shouldn't just like kind of happen and whatever. It should feel like there's no way it's going to happen, and then it does. And this movie is that way, right? It's this miracle ending, and then it's taken away, and it's pretty rough. Pretty rough. Okay, so villain John.
In the running for my favorite name, of course. Her name is Nini Legs in the Air, is her name. And she's one of the dancers in Moulin Rouge, and she's the one who just says, just out of nowhere, oh, well, why does she marry the penniless writer? Whoops, I mean the sitar player.
Oh, that's my villain.
Yeah, it's like, what is she doing? It's just like, she's so evil that she just has to point out the obvious thing, that, and she has to annoy everybody by saying that. Like, I don't know what motivation she had for doing that, but she's the villain.
Yeah, like, I really have no idea what she stood to gain from that, other than like...
Yeah, they're the welfare of the Moulin Rouge is at stake here.
Yeah. All right, Richard, who's your villain?
I had to go for the obvious, which, I mean, you alluded that your villain talked to my villain, the Duke.
The Duke. He's great.
Which,
he does a great job.
He's so creepy and so... he's like, she will be mine. She's mine. It'll be my ending, my way. Oof.
All right, then. Let's see. Where are we? Hero. Richard, who's your hero?
I only speak the truth. I only speak the truth. So I guess that means Toulouse.
He's pretty good, yeah. Is that who you got, John? Right.
I want to say – I wanted to bring this up. I don't know – I didn't study Toulouse-Lautrec like in real life. I don't know who he was. I kind of – I finally hit on who he is because I'm not sure if he was the greatest artist, but what he brought into the world at the dawn of the 20th century is the attitude that we kind of have now. Like it was more about attitude than talent or art or anything, and that's what I think of Toulouse-Lautrec, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, very good. I copped out and I just chose love. The hero is love.
Oh, that wasn't my hero.
Oh, who's your hero then?
My hero is the song "Heroes" by David Bowie, as sung by Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor. It's my favorite version of Heroes.
It's a good one. Yeah. We could be heroes.
Mm. We could be lovers. Yes.
We can't do that.
Okay. Best movie goof then, Jonathan.
Gosh, I don't know if we've talked about this, but I mean, don't you think it's a coincidence that all the English speakers in France are like just combined into the Moulin Rouge at the same time?
That's not realistic at all. That's pretty
cool. That's what I put. Yeah.
Similarly, you think you can kick a gun through the glass ceiling of the Moulin Rouge and then it hits the Eiffel Tower? Not realistic.
That's what I should have picked. Oh, wait, no, I have another one. Sorry, I have to pick this one. I don't remember the last time I was singing a love song and then the moon joined me to sing also. Zero stars.
Zero stars. What a dumb movie. None of that could happen. All right, so Richard, what's your goof?
In Across the Universe, the fictional Ohio high school that Prudence went to, they had a team called the Wildcats the year after High School Musical comes out. That is a blunder. You can't just name your team the Wildcats and not be referencing High School Musical. That's a different musical.
That was also the mascot in the Wonder Years. I feel like people are really going nuts with just the Wildcats mascot in media.
Because it's not so much in real life. It's much less. Yeah. In the reality, in the real world.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what's the opposite of representation? That's not what we need right here. No more Wildcat representation. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do funniest moment. Richard, what was the funniest moment in these films?
The lead up to your song where, like we had talked about earlier, Nicole Kidman or Satine is just finding everything that Ewan McGregor or Christian is saying just like very sexy because she's putting on the act. Yeah. And it's all a big sexual innuendo, the whole thing. And I thought that was hilarious.
Okay, John, what about you?
All right. Unfortunately, I was working on these awards during the podcast, and I was looking through in my notes. I don't have any specific notes of laughter because these were kind of some serious movies.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I did found a pretty good one, and it's when when Alana puts the Dear Evan Hansen actual letter online, and it backfires. So okay,
that was pretty funny, huh?
That was a humor type known as irony.
Yes, we'll go
okay.
that way, yeah.
So mine is from Moulin Rouge when they're out on a picnic and the Duke says, "My dear, a little frog."
Oh, yes. Okay, that's a good one.
He's always
it's hilarious.
A little okay, frog.
Back to and the oblivious. The key of D minor, John. What was the very saddest moment?
Okay, I'm going to have to go with Moulin Rouge, and it's when Ziedler's trying to convince Satine to go through with their plan, and she says, "Okay, I quit. That's it. I don't need any of this, you know." And then he says, "Satine, you're dying." And just the whole idea that like something so stupid as death can just erases all other plans in the world. And I don't know. It's just straightforward and brutal. So I'll have to go with that one.
Okay. What about you, Richard?
When Evan Hansen is like crying into his mother's lap on the couch and Julianne Moore is like comforting him. And I remember seeing it live and it was really like Ben Platt just cries on command really well. And it like stirs up a lot of emotion. And so both in the real life version of the Broadway musical and in the movie version, I found it very sad.
So Similarly, in Dear Evan Hansen, I'm going to go with the dinner party where his mother is invited over and she's made to feel very out of place, not intentionally, but then also she, you know, Amy Adams offers to pay for Evan's schooling and it's just a disaster. And then the big fight that her and Evan have in the parking lot, and it just breaks my heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, what's your what the heck moment, Richard?
I guess it's when they go to that circus scene and find Prudence, and it's all very, like, surreal. Like, it's not very realistic. I say it's what the heck is going on here, but also I kind of liked it. But oh, it was very crazy.
I'm gonna drill down specifically to the merpeople, which was just so bizarre.
Yeah, that specifically was very bizarre.
What about you, John?
Merman. After the circus part, it just when they just wound. Okay, they have this really weird sequence, and then they're just back in New York City, and I'm like, oh, what? So the movie started over? What's going on?
Okay, well, John, what's your favorite quote?
Christian and Satine finally get together kind of toward the beginning of the movie, and she just kind of has the foreboding quote with a smile where she says, "You're going to be bad for business, I can tell." Because she's a courtesan.
Yeah. What about you, Richard?
The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. That one.
Very good. So, couple quick honorable mentions. At the end of Across the Universe, when they're singing All You Need Is Love, and then someone shouts out the John Lennon ad lib where John Lennon says, "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah." I love that. And then also from Dear Evan Hansen, from the song that I chose, the lyric that says, "The parts we can't tell, we carry them well, but that doesn't mean they're not heavy." But then the best quote has got to be, "She doesn't love you! Him!"
Oh, that's good. Yes.
Okay, Richard, your favorite scene?
I went with the tango, and specifically, like John said, because Ewan McGregor as Christian singing the counterpart to it, it was just very dramatic, and it built tension, and it was impressive. So, best scene.
What about you, John?
Okay, interesting. Best scene, because I picked, thanks, Richard, because I picked the tango for my best song, but for my best scene, it might actually be my best song, but I picked it for best scene because it was the best scene, and it was the scene, it was the, "My gift is my song," and it was the, you know, meeting Satine, the seduction of Satine using your song, which I thought was just, kind of like how I said, you know, it's my favorite version of Heroes. This is also definitely my favorite version of your song.
Did you ever listen to the Punch Up the Jams about your song?
Did I? I'm sure I did.
Okay, because they tear it apart because, like, it's a love song, but the entire song is about the song, right? The song is like, "My gift is this song. Here it is. I wrote it for you." And it's this song that we're listening to right now. Here
so it's kind of like,
do you like it?
It's kind of like, this is not the greatest song in the world. This is just a tribute.
This is a tribute, yeah. Okay, well, my favorite scene, honorable mention to the bowling scene in Across the Universe when they're singing I've Just Seen a Face. I'm going to go ahead and give best scene, though, to Evan talks to his mom when he's fully honest with his mom. That's pretty darn good. All right, best actor, John.
Okay, there's only one choice here, and that's Jim Broadbent as Harold Zeidler. It's like he's a cartoon. How did this cartoon come to life?
Yeah, he's my honorable mention. Richard, who's your favorite actor?
I went with Nicole Kidman because I think she knocked it out of the park.
She really nailed the Australian-French accent.
Exactly.
She is really good. I went with 45-year-old Ben Platt. I thought he did really well. So
perfect.
Oh, there you go. All right. I had one unanswered question. I know we kind of skipped this before we get to the special awards. In your opinion, did the letter that Connor intercepted, did that push him over the edge, or was he going to commit suicide anyway?
I hope it didn't push him over the edge because
I struggled with that. I'm like, oh my gosh, Evan killed him. And I didn't want that to be the case.
What I've learned reading online about people who do end up ending their own life, that no one made them do it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So I don't think he should take responsibility.
I would say no either. I mean, that thought didn't cross my mind. I guess maybe because I'm the jerk who just who never liked Connor. I just don't like the guy.
All right.
We don't get to know Connor really at all until pretty much the end of the movie, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gift that he's able to give to back to Connor's parents to show him playing the guitar and singing that song. So it's a nice little something that they can hang on to. Anyway, all right, special awards, biggest show.
Wait. Question. I have questions.
No, you don't.
Let me ask my questions.
Okay, fine. In
Dear Evan Hansen, we see the viral speech going everywhere, but from what I understand of musicals, like in the reality, is the musicals are meant to express, you know, the emotion of the characters, and they're not like it, because if it was real life, of course they're not singing. So did the message go viral? Did his eulogy go viral because he was actually singing out of nowhere?
So I chose to believe that his viral message was a speech, and that we only hear it as a song because this is a musical.
I mean, that's got to be. I think it's just, I just don't understand. I just can't see a speech going viral like that. Any speech that's 5 minutes long.
Can you see like a crippled with anxiety kind of person like Evan just breaking into like opera, right? I know.
Zero stars. Okay. And then in Moulin Rouge, since nothing, okay, Satine died, that's one thing, but also this whole deal that they were, all these characters were, you know, walking on eggshells to get by, that must not have happened. So did the Moulin Rouge, did it just go under?
It went under.
Yeah. Okay. Last question. And this always seems to come up, but we never touched on it at all. But what is the significance of the names Christian and Satine? Because it sounds like Christ and Satan to me.
Ooh. I don't know. I don't know either.
Is it doomed? Is that the significance? I don't know.
Well, as far as I remember in the Bible, Christ and Satan are not allowed to fall in love. And so maybe we're just repeating that story over again.
That's the story, the classic story of the Bible. Like, you know, the whole Bible kept Christ and Satan from becoming
star-crossed lovers, those two.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, cool. Those are all my questions.
Yeah, I guess in
unanswered.
Not really. Sorry, my computer's making a lot of noise right now. But in French, satin means satin, which is what I thought it meant.
Oh.
So it's more like satin and Christian. So maybe I still think that, you know, Christians aren't supposed to fall in love with fabric. So I think it's okay.
This movie warned us.
Yeah.
I was deprived of so much silk as a teenager because I wasn't allowed. Uh-huh. Anyway.
It's the more sexy of the materials.
Yeah. All right. Cool times. Okay, special awards. The biggest showstopper, Richard.
The show must go on. The show must go on. Yeah.
We haven't talked about The Show Must Go On, but that's what I also picked as my showstopper, partly because it's amazing, and I love the background of the song, because it was like the last Queen song, right? You know, Freddie Mercury recorded The Show Must Go On, and then he died. That's just amazing. And it's like used so well here. But also, I like it in this award because of the irony of the show must go on. The show shouldn't stop. So therefore, showstopper, I don't know. Oh, it's irony. Yeah.
There that is again, that word.
Yeah.
Irony.
So I wanted to do You Will Be Found, but it doesn't seem like that's the song where it ends and everyone just jumps up and erupts in cheering. So I kind of just went with the whole Welcome to the Moulin Rouge montage, that whole intro where it's like you're getting not slapped in the face, but repeatedly kneed and elbowed and headbutted in the face. with what the Moulin Rouge is.
So the show starts by stopping.
The show started by stopping.
Yeah.
All right. What about the best singer, Richard?
I had to go with Ben Platt as Evan Hansen. Okay. Yeah.
Well, John, what you got?
Didn't like his singing. That's just me. And I know this is definitely wrong because he's not a professional singer. And I think it might be pretty obvious, but I actually went with Ewan McGregor because I'd never heard him sing before until he does that, you know, my gift is my song. And he just, you know, he has that, you know, kind of high voice that he kind of belts out. And I think he'd really, he let us have it right from the start.
Could have done a good Javert, maybe.
Ah, as Javert, yes, okay. Definitely. In fact, that would have been good.
I think Jeffrey Rush could have sung better than Russell Crowe. Anyway.
Cast Nicole Kidman as Javert. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay, best appropriation of a song, John. What was your favorite appropriated song?
My favorite appropriation.
As far as how it worked in the movie, yep.
Is... Well, my favorite – well, I kind of took it a little bit different. I found it like appropriation, like almost like the best kidnapping of a song in a way. That's how I took it. So I went with Smells Like Teen Spirit just because it threw a lot of grungers off their game to like see their beloved Smells Like Teen Spirit used in such a commercial way.
People were freaking out, huh?
Yeah.
What about you, Richard? Best appropriated song?
My gift is my song, and this one's for you. Yeah, I agree with everything John said about your song. And Elton John did it well, but Ewan McGregor did it better.
Nice. Yes, wow. I agree.
Okay, I think I'm going back to the bowling scene with I've Just Seen a Face. It was lovely. Although I would have been tempted to If I Fell by Rachel Evan Wood. Is that her name?
Yeah,
I thought she did a really lovely rendition of that song.
Rachel Evan Hansen Wood.
There you go.
Ooh, a crossover character we didn't even reckon for. Mm.
A crossover universe character.
All right. The part in these movies that Richard is just born to play, and I'm going with Zidler. John, what do you think?
Ooh.
I thought about Zidler, especially for the fast motion thing. But this is a smaller part, but I think he'll crush it because he's like so over the top when he's awake. But the narcoleptic Argentinian.
Yes.
Well, what about you, Richard? Which of these parts is the one that you feel you were born to play?
Well, I feel a little prideful that I just wanted to be the lead of Moulin Rouge and be Christian. Mm. But I do want to play that role, and the songs are all really great. Mm. So probably not. I probably would be a Harold Ziegler or Ziedler better, you know?
You'd be great, Harold Zidler, buddy.
You'd be a great Christian, I think. Yeah, I'll cast you in my version of Moulin Rouge.
Or a great Satan or Satan, either way.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, enough of this nonsense. Let's rank these stupid movies. Richard, you're going to start so you can also be the first to reveal your number one. So what's your third favorite of these 21st century musicals?
I think my third favorite will be Across the Universe, and it's not because I didn't think it was a great movie. I thought, like, visually stunning and well-directed and well-sung, but just what we talked about, like, the minor things of you're writing a plot based on the Beatles songs alone, and not much extra thought was put into it. So that's the only ding it gets, is they just pieced the plot together. So that's my least favorite, yeah.
Oh, very good. John? What is your least favorite?
All right. I'm not saying I like this movie, but I will have to say Across the Universe, hey, everybody, strap yourselves into a Clockwork Orange device, peel your eyes open, and watch people stand in front of 400 Beatles songs.
Okay. Well, I love the Beatles, and my third favorite is Across the Universe.
Whoa!
But for the reasons we talked about. And so Now we're coming back around, and my second favorite, and I was surprised that this happened. My second favorite is Moulin Rouge.
Wow.
Go ahead, John.
My second favorite is Dear Evan Hansen. I liked it a lot more talking about it with you, gentlemen.
Oh, well, thank you. And Richard, what is your second and then your very favorite?
So my second favorite will be Dear Evan Hansen. I think the movie did improve upon things when it came to like delving into characters. Like we mentioned, they wrote extra songs for Alana, and we got that reveal with Connor in the rehab playing his guitar that we don't get in the musical. So these are very lovely film moments that I did think were good. But they did cut out some of the music from the musical that would have helped the story even more. So I'm going to ding it a little bit, which means my favorite is Moulin Rouge. It's perfect.
I love Moulin Rouge. It was really fun to see it again. I'm glad it won the audience participation, and I'm so glad the Facebook group has, I don't know, evolved out of voting for movies they know we won't like. So good job. Nice good maturity, job. You know, on the Facebook group. But I think, again, it's the Baz Luhrmann movie I like, and somehow it struck perfectly, and it resonates perfectly with me, maybe. And it might just be a me thing, because on paper, it's just so over the top and overblown, but it's over the top and overblownness that's strained and so filled with artificiality, but somehow there's no facade to it for me, and that's just for me. But the big news, of course, is Roy, you were not excited to watch Dear Evan Hansen because you heard so many bad things, and now it's your favorite movie.
I did, but it was close because I saw Moulin Rouge first because I watched them in order, John, and I thought Moulin Rouge was tremendous. It's tremendous, but Dear Evan Hansen just really struck a chord. So you know, there you go.
More than one chord.
Yeah, a couple chords. So
yeah.
All right.
It's good. It's a good film.
Yeah. And so I also don't have the benefit of having it, of having seen the stage show. So, you know, like you said, there's some things that it could have done better, that it missed some opportunities. I'm not aware of those missed opportunities. So what do you know? All right, gentlemen, that was great. And it's time to put the past behind us and look to the future. John, if you could dial in Ammon, he is ready.
All right. Let's see if we can do this. I hope Skype is always a crapshoot, so we'll see you here. Dialing in. Hey. Welcome, Ammon.
Yeah, hey. While we got you real quick, we just finished talking about 21st Century Musicals, Moulin Rouge, Across the Universe, and Dear Evan Hansen, and do you have any quick thoughts? Rapid fire thoughts.
I've only ever seen Moulin Rouge, which I adore. I love over-the-top Baz Luhrmann. I know, JR, long time issue. I don't care about the Beatles. I don't dislike them. I just don't care about them.
You would love Across the Universe then,
I would think, because...
Is that also they also don't care about the Beatles?
in a way.
Okay.
And well, Dear Evan Hansen, I know the kids love it, and that's all I know about it, is that the kids love it.
Well, it was an interesting discussion because the critics tore it apart. Like, it's like in the 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. But I think that the three of us mostly thought it was a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
At least we all thought it was better than Across the Universe anyway. So, all right then.
Yeah. What was your top? Can I ask? Or is that, I guess, yeah.
So, if you're asking, my top was Dear Evan Hansen, then Moulin Rouge. But it was really close because I think Moulin Rouge is really, really good. But these two jokers both picked Moulin Rouge as their number one.
Yeah, love Moulin Rouge. Love Moulin Rouge. Right. It's the good Luhrmann, the good Baz, the only one.
as opposed to the Elvis Baz.
I'm gonna have to go see the Elvis.
I haven't seen it yet.
I mean, just to clinch it for me. But I don't know. I've heard
you'll have
I've
to clinch
too Luhrmann-y. Where Moulin Rouge is the most Luhrmann movie ever. Everything after that is too Luhrmann-y, but not as Luhrmann. So I don't know. I don't know how it even works.
As Luhrmann, I like that.
All right, Ammon. Well, we all are right, excited. Yeah. Three movies you've never seen before.
So I made a huge list, and then I threw it away because I decided that if the problem with movies that I haven't seen before, I was thinking about doing movies that I hadn't seen before that I should have. And so The Godfather 3 was on there, and I couldn't tell if you hadn't seen that or not. Mm-hmm. But ultimately what I did is I went to three people in my life and said to them, what's the movie that I haven't seen that I should have? I went to my brother, who's a cinephile, and he said, and he's been saying for a long time, Hot Fuzz. But you guys have already watched Hot Fuzz.
Oh, we can't watch that. It's really good.
But I don't believe you've watched RoboCop.
Oh!
And I've actually never seen RoboCop.
Oh, my goodness.
So. Oh, Ammon. Oh, gosh. You might be too old for RoboCop now because it's because it's for 12-year-olds, but also it's for 21-year-olds who are like, oh, I get RoboCop. Do you have a thing for – okay, wait. Have you ever seen – gosh, what's another Verhoeven movie? Like, because he did Basic Instinct. He did Total Recall.
And I've seen Total Recall, yeah.
Black Book. Oh, Starship Troopers is the one I'm thinking because, you know, there's the big, huge discourse of Starship Troopers where, you know, you see that as a young person. You're like, oh, yeah, killing bugs. And look at this crappy early CGI in all these bugs. But then, you know, then everybody talks about, like, just how much of a parody it is, you know, and how it was, like, meant to be. But I don't know. Yeah, I like Starship Troopers. RoboCop, too.
I want to tell you, Ammon, that my brother Josh recently said you're his favorite guest on his podcast, and that's you're about to rise at least 200% in his esteem.
Right. This is really clinching it. It's like you're leaving everyone in the dust with your RoboCop pick. Yeah,
I've never seen RoboCop, so I'm actually really excited.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. The other two. So, and tonally, by the way, so I went to my brother Enoch, who's a cinephile. Mm-hmm. I went to my oldest daughter Elena. And I went to my wife, Emily. Okay. And tonally, these three movies, I'm going to be very curious how we can fit them all together tonally.
Okay.
Because they're very different movies. But I'm excited to see all of them. So Emily had wanted me to see. She's now, I feel bad and because like we both agree that there's a movie that we were just talking about that I had never seen that she was stunned I'd never seen. But it's lost to the ages. We'll never remember what it is. But she had seen this indie movie 2 years ago, which I had actually not even heard of. I don't know what you guys have. And it's called Tully. So the star is Charlize Theron. And she's like suffering from postpartum. That's what IMDb says. So I think it's not going to be a lot like RoboCop, but I could be wrong.
I've seen Tully.
How do you spell this
movie? You have seen Tully.
Yeah.
Tully.
Yeah.
Tully, 2018. Okay. Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay.
So that's my second. Yeah, and I know nothing about it. I've like literally heard of it. And she told me about it when she saw it, and I forgot about it because I'm a
keep
bad person.
Knowing nothing about it.
That's my goal.
Okay.
And so then Elena and I have been listening to this podcast about Amityville Horror.
Oh man.
We've been talking about watching Amityville Horror for a long time, I don't think you guys.
No.
I'll have to ask. It's some sort of like it was about the book, not about the movie.
So, but this wasn't the podcast that the guy from that CNN sponsored, and it was done by the guy from the Kids on the Block.
No.
Okay.
No,
all right.
Not that. It was like some like you know millennials like who were like reading the novel. It was very funny though, and the novel. I guess I mean, it was supposedly true, right? But the true story of Amityville Horror sounds amazing. And so we've been talking about watching it. And so she's like, this is, let's watch Amityville Horror together. And obviously, I think it goes without saying, I'm talking about the 1975 or 78 version or whatever.
Oh, not man.
Okay, version. Just making sure. Okay, I thought that's what you meant. But
1979
yeah.
with James yeah. Brolin?
James yes. Brolin, Amityville Horror.
Which I know we're all fans of James Brolin, so...
Well, he's yeah,
totally. Those three movies should be really, really. It would be interesting to have a conversation about those three movies at the same time.
I can't tell you how excited I am. These are awesome movies.
These are good. You're not letting us down. So, okay. So that is next time. Roy, what do we have to look forward to after that?
Into the Wild movies, which we will be voting on the Facebook page shortly.
Okay, good. And then who's next?
Melissa's going to torture us with some movies. I'm actually scared. I'm as nervous about her picks as I was when you decided to have us watch Duke of Burgundy. So
okay. Okay, cool. Well, that's it. Okay. Richard, and I feel like I'm going to mention this again to you because I mentioned it to you off the air. I just apologies in advance because we're not doing a Star Trek podcast in the near future, and
Sorry.
You're like one of our three listeners of the Star Trek podcast. We just haven't caught up on Star Trek, so we're going to get to that. But your Star Trek positivity has kept me alive. So thank you for that, Richard. But most of all, thank you for joining us the past 2 weeks. And you doubly joined us because you were at the live event. And I just feel like, you know, we've been hanging out with you this whole time. So it's been really great. It's time to say goodbye. But if you ever want to just Skype call in, just prank call in, you know, on some Thursday night, then, you know, then, yeah, we'll just get you in. We'll just
and,
do it.
And we hope and expect that you will come back next year with three movies you've never seen before.
Yes.
We'll have a good
absolutely.
Time.
Yes. Thank you.
Yay. All right. Thank you, Richard. New beginnings with Ammon. Ammon, I can't wait. 2 weeks from tonight, we're going to do it.
I'm very excited also.
All right. Cool. All right. Hey, thank you, guys. Ammon, thanks. Can't wait. Richard, you've been a blast. I've had such a good time. And, of course, John, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. And get well soon, sir.
All right.
Discovery just had a rough time finding its footing, but I agree that season two, when we introduced Pike and Spock, that actually was one of the stronger seasons. So it made sense to spin off that into a TV show. So I think they, even though we're oversaturated with Star Trek, I would rather be oversaturated than not have it, because we've lived both sides of that coin.
Right, right. The dearth and the of the mid-2000s of just not having Star Trek.
Yeah.
Although, let me think about this.
The dearth gave birth to this podcast.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.